Theater was nothing but a failure. Now I know just who I am. Spider-Man. Once I was helpless. Now I rescue those who need me when I can. Spider-Man. Oh,
hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We are talking Spider-Man again, but this time we're talking Spider-Man, the video game on PS4 by Insomniac. It is an amazing, wonderful game. We talked a lot about it last week on the show in spoiler-free detail. Gave some first impressions because neither of us was done with the game. We have both now completed the game. I platinumed it on Wednesday. Have you gotten that far?
Yes, I platinumed it on Friday.
Awesome.
And then I spent a lot of yesterday swinging around the city listening to Spider-Man albums and taking photos.
That sounds fun. Awesome. I went right back into Dragon Quest, so it's been on the shelf since I platinumed it. But we both have played about as much of the game as you could reasonably expect us to play. So 100% of the whole thing. We will be talking about it in detail today. There will be spoilers, but we will give you ample warning, and there's other content today before then, including we are going to talk about this week's Nintendo Direct. This is the event that was delayed because of the earthquake in Japan and finally came out on Thursday of this week, September 13th. And I have copious notes on that. I actually, when it happened, I was thinking, oh, that was kind of an underwhelming Direct. And then I went back through my notes, and I have two full pages. It was actually a really stacked event. So I'm excited to talk about that. That will be the majority of our show today. Very excited to talk about this great game. Sean, what else have you been up to?
Nothing. It's just been it's been Spider-Man. I'm happy to, now that I've finished playing Spider-Man, I can resume the diligent hard work of reading Spider-Man, because that was on break for a little bit. So now I'm reading a lot of Spider-Man comics again. So it's been Spider-Man is my life.
Awesome. I have been sick. You can hear it in my voice. I don't know what's going on. The only thing I can think is that... So I've been in Iowa for about 5 weeks now, Sean. And that is the longest I've ever been outside of the state of Colorado since I was 6 years old. I've never been out of the state that long. And I think my body is just revolting. I think my allergies and, like, my immune system are just like... Fuck you, Jonathan. Get back to those fucking mountains and that low or high atmosphere. And I'm like, I gotta be here, buddy. And it's like, no, we're gonna give you the mother of all runny noses for an entire Saturday and make you go out at 8 p.m. to a Walgreens to buy Benadryl. And so that's what I did. And Benadryl, it knocks you the fuck out. I don't know what's in that stuff. But yeah, that's been my weekend. So I binged the entire fifth season of BoJack Horseman. I played like another 14 hours of Dragon Quest XI this week, because I have not had the energy for anything else.
I do like the idea of your body just going like, hey, where the fuck you at? What you doing, boy? Get back home. Get out of here. What are you doing in Iowa? Go home.
It's like if your dog, if you go out somewhere that the dog doesn't know where you are, it's just pulling you back like, no, I want to go that way. And I'm like, we have to be here. We'll be okay. There's nothing that should be making you react this way, body. It's just it's not even that far away from Colorado. It's not that different. It's a little more humid.
You've just got that Iowa sickness.
Got that Iowa sickness, yeah. So I don't know what's going on. I've got a doctor's appointment, but it's the beginning of the semester, and everyone's got doctor's appointments, so it's taking a while.
Yeah.
That's my life right now. But yes, I did mention I binged the entire fifth season of BoJack Horseman on Netflix. Have you ever watched that show, Sean?
No, I have yet to get around to it.
Why? You have to. You need to. It is, I am confident now saying that we have five seasons under our belt. This is one of the five shows of the decade for me, the decade almost being wrapped up. The other ones I listed off the top of my head on Twitter today were Hannibal, The Leftovers, Twin Peaks, and Better Call Saul. And I think I would slot BoJack Horseman right up in there with them. And this season in particular is just something else. Like last year, I think I've always said to myself and other people, the way to describe BoJack Horseman is it is either the funniest sad show on TV or the saddest funny show on TV. And I actually think the last two seasons have leaned more towards the saddest funny show and not the funniest sad show. Or maybe funniest. I don't know what way it goes. It's very, very sad. The last couple episodes this year, my God, they go to some places. There's an episode in the middle that is such an audacious format-breaking episode of television. It will blow your mind and break your heart. And also this season deals with horrible people in Hollywood in a really interesting way. It pretty directly confronts the entire Me Too movement and the wave of things we've learned about horrible men in Hollywood and how fundamentally the industry is built to not make people take responsibility for their actions. And it's a real indictment not only of Hollywood, but I think of American culture. And it's the smartest one I've seen in any movie or TV show since this really became part of the cultural zeitgeist in the last couple of years. And I can't recommend this show highly enough. It is truly special. There's truly nothing else like it. It still makes you sound like an insane person explaining this show because he's a fucking horse. And this year he's a horse who's addicted to painkillers and opiates. But good God, the show has its own world, and in that world, you will laugh and you will cry and you will be amazed at what is going on. And I just cannot endorse this show strongly enough. It is the best thing Netflix has ever given us.
Well, I'll put it on my list to watch once I'm done reading Spider-Man 10 years from now.
Okay.
Because the I don't have enough time to watch TV shows and read Spider-Man comic books and play video games and do the other stuff.
I gotcha. The nice thing about BoJack Horseman is you can watch it very fast. They're like 25-minute episodes. There's only 12 of them a season. There's a lot of episodes by now, but still, like, I did this season in 3 days, and I say binged. It's not that hard. It's like 4 hours of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it all comes together. But anyway, that's very good. I'm still loving Dragon Quest XI. Dragon Quest XI, I'm about 27 hours into now, so I played a lot of it this week. And it's just such a terrific game. It's a really nice game to play while you're feeling sick, because it does not demand that much of you. It's just like, come on, chill with us, see a cool story, visit some cool towns. But I love this game. I'm going to wait to say anything too much more substantial about it until you've played some of it, and we can have a back and forth on it. But I will highlight two things that I love about this game this week. One, this game has my favorite item crafting in any video game ever. In Dragon Quest XI, when you go to your campsite, you have access to something called the Fun-Sized Forge, which looks like this little Fisher-Price version of a blacksmith's forge. And you can make new armor and equipment or rework your old armor and equipment. And the mini-game associated with the crafting is an insanely addictive amount of fun, and I have spent probably hours already on my Fun-Sized Forge. It is a fantastic part of this game, and I love it.
You should be careful who you say that phrase to. I spent hours on my Fun-Sized Forge. It sounds like if you didn't have the proper context, that sounds like something else.
It sounds like a use of euphemism that would be on the television show BoJack Horseman I was just talking about. All right. Anyway, but yes. I also want to say Dragon Quest XI has unequivocally the best towns I have ever seen in a video game, JRPG or otherwise. The towns in Dragon Quest, you go into them, and they are so ludicrously beautiful and creatively designed and artistically driven, and it feels like you're really going all around the world, and there's so much to just look at in these towns, and there is a story being told in something as simple as what they have placed on tables, and the people are so interesting to talk to, and there's just cool shit to find. And I just, every time I get to a town in Dragon Quest XI, I just know to strap in, because I'm going to spend an hour poking around that town before I do anything remotely related to the story of this game. And I love it, and I cannot wait for you to see it too, Sean, because I mean it. The towns in this game are something else. And that's not something I ever really think about, especially in a JRPG. It's like the towns are the towns. You go there and you stay at the inn, right? But they are a genuine draw of this video game. And if you want to see some really good video game towns, you should play Dragon Quest XI: Echoes of an Elusive Age for PS4.
Yes, I do have my copy of Dragon Quest XI in Japanese. It got here a couple of days ago, but I have not started playing it. I put it into the PS4 at some point because I was doing something else. I'm like, I might as well, while I'm doing this other thing, just get that loaded up and all that. So it is ready to go when I'm ready to go.
I'm excited for you to play it. Okay, third thing. In one of the awesome towns that I mentioned, there is a casino that you can go play at. And I'm like, oh, cool, a video game casino. Those are kind of fun sometimes. holy shit, the casino in Dragon Quest XI is the most scary thing I've ever seen in a video game, because it's just an actual fucking casino. Like, with actual fucking, like, casino stakes, and it will take your money like an actual casino. Luckily, there's no microtransactions associated with this game, or I would be bankrupt right now in real life, because I spent, like, an hour in that casino, and I didn't know what happened. But I know I walked out of it with no gold left. And I did get the plans to make a bunny suit, because that's something you needed for a quest. But other than that, it's scary. You'll see what I mean. There are fucking slot machines, and they're not, like, fun video game slot machines. They're slot machines.
Okay, then. Maybe you should stay away from Vegas, Jonathan. That's just judging by this conversation.
I've always known that about myself. I know if I ever allowed myself to, gambling would be like my horrible vice, and I just stay the fuck away from it. I have heard this about Dragon Quest before. I think the casino thing is not new to this game. It's been a thing they've been doing forever. But I just seeing it, I'm like, oh god, this is the real deal. It's not like fun, like, you know, New Super Mario Bros. On the DS, where you can play poker with Luigi, and it's just goofy. It's like, no, it's poker, and it's scary, and they actually made the rules harder than actual poker. I don't get it. So, yeah. This game has a lot going on in it.
Nice.
All right. So you want to move on to the news?
Yeah. What's going on in the news, Jonathan? The Nintendo Direct? Is that what we got today?
The Nintendo Direct. That's the only news I have on the outline for today, because it was a lot. Like I said earlier, I watched this Direct live, and I enjoyed it, but I thought, yeah, that was kind of light. Like, I don't care. This was not like a big E3 event or anything. It was just kind of one of their out-of-the-blue Directs. But again, when I go through it, there was a lot I took notes on, and there are a lot of things that I've been thinking about since the announcements, because there was some cool stuff that rolled out here. Did you get a chance to watch it, or just some select things?
I picked up the couple of things I wanted to watch, like the Isabel reveal, and my favorite one, the one I'm most excited to talk about just in general, not for, like, good stuff, but just the most interesting, is their, like, weird 3-minute video about the Nintendo Switch Online thing, which was just, like, strange.
Get to it.
I did watch all of those in Japanese, because the way I knew the Nintendo Direct happened was my YouTube feed exploded with Japanese Nintendo YouTube videos, because I'm subscribed to their Japanese account for reasons detailed in a podcast a couple of months ago. So that's the only way I know that Nintendo does anything anymore. I need Cat Mario puppets to tell me.
All right, well, let's start with where they started. This Nintendo Direct began with the announcement of Luigi's Mansion 3 for Nintendo Switch. It was like a 1-minute video of Luigi walking around a mansion in HD. And I was kind of curious what this was, because this had not been rumored. There were a lot of things in this Direct that had been rumored or leaked, and then after the delay because of the earthquake, a lot more just came out through, like, their partners at Square Enix and places. But there had been no inkling of this whatsoever, and I was wondering, oh, well, they're doing Luigi's Mansion on 3DS. Maybe they're also doing a port to Nintendo Switch. That would make sense. But it's not. It's a full third game in the series. The second game in the series came out for the 3DS a couple years ago. That one was called Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon. And, yeah, they said Luigi's Mansion 3. It's coming 2019. And there you go. And I think that's pretty cool. That's a cool, like, weird sub-series they have. And I think it would be fun to see that in HD with the full power of a modern console.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how, like, a decade plus later, Nintendo, like, kind of turned on Luigi's Mansion, where it felt like, because Luigi's Mansion, for people who don't remember, was a launch game on the GameCube. So that was fucking forever ago. That was like 2000, 2001. And so it wasn't until that 3DS game that was like, you know, people like Luigi's Mansion. And it's like, well, we make another one of this. It's like, that was like 15 years ago. Like, if you were born when Luigi's Mansion came out, you're in high school now.
Luigi's Mansion had a weird cult tale, because it was considered a disappointment when it came out. It was like, this is the non-Mario Mario game we're getting at launch because they don't have anything else. Like, I remember that pretty distinctly about the GameCube, because everyone wanted Smash Bros., but Smash Bros. Got delayed a couple months later after the GameCube's launch, and so they had Luigi's Mansion on day one, and I think a lot of people wrote it off, but the people who played it tended to really like it, and years later, it's become this real cult classic, and now it's getting, you know, this prime slot announcement on the Nintendo Direct. That's kind of crazy to me.
Yeah, I also think Nintendo is maybe a little bit confused in their messaging on Luigi, because in their last Direct, they fucking killed the motherfucker. In the next Direct, they give him his own game. So it's like, fucking pick one. Do you hate Luigi? Do you love Luigi? You can't kill him and give him his own game. You have to pick one.
Well, maybe they'll do one of their patented Nintendo convoluted timelines for us and explain where Luigi's death relates. Like, maybe Luigi's Mansion 3 is a prequel, and at the end of the game, someone calls him and is like, Luigi, you did such a good job with this third mansion you cleared of ghosts. You know, great work, Luigi. We would like you to come to Transylvania and clear this fucking vampire house for us. And he's like, I'll do it. And he goes to Transylvania, and he gets fucking killed by Dracula.
Yeah, I am really looking forward to them releasing the Historica Luigia. it'll be a great coffee book. Coffee table.
All right. They then announced some 3DS stuff. So we got Kirby's Extra Epic Yarn for 3DS. This is a remake of the Wii game. I actually forgot this was not a Wii U game. This game is older than I thought. Kirby's Epic Yarn was a Wii game from 2010, so it's 9 years old now. This will be coming to 3DS in 2019. I never played this game, so looks kind of cool. Probably easier to play it this way than on the Wii at this point. This game got kind of a spiritual successor later with Yoshi's Woolly World, but this was the original yarn-based Nintendo game, and they're doing that on 3DS. We've got Mario & Luigi Bowser's Inside Story. This was already revealed earlier this year, but they gave another couple details here. That's coming January 11th, 2019. They reminded us about Luigi's Mansion on the 3DS, the port of it. They showed off some two-player co-op. They showed off the co-op. They showed off Amiibo support. Confirmed that is coming October 12th, 2018, so in a couple weeks here. And they reminded us about Yo-Kai Watch Blasters on 3DS. And really just a segment that confirmed that the 3DS is now a port machine, and that is how it is spending its retirement.
Yeah, it is in that phase of its life that all consoles, successful consoles, go to, which is like, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to have FIFA games for the next 10 years, because why not? Which is like what the PS2 did in its waning, you know, its sunset years.
And yeah, it's weird, because the 3DS is not being supported. Those are all games, and they're probably good ones, but it's not getting anything substantively new at this point.
It is also weird when you think, go back to like the Luigi's Mansion 3 thing. It really feels like that should have been coupled with and then we're porting Luigi's Mansion 1, and we're putting the version of the 3DS sequel on the Switch also. That feels like that would have been a nice, to get all those things together. Obviously, that's not like simple or free to do for Nintendo, but it is kind of weird when you think about Luigi's Mansion 1 coming to the 3DS, Luigi's Mansion 3 coming to the Switch, both being in the same direct.
It is weird, and you know, when they announced the Luigi's Mansion 3DS port back at E3, I think it was, a lot of people were upset it wasn't coming to Switch, and I said, well, look, I think this makes sense. The 3DS needs games. It already had the sequel. Might as well put the original on there, make them both playable on the 3DS. I still like my 3DS. I think Luigi's Mansion is a natural fit. You know, go for it. But now that we know they're doing a full sequel for Switch, it does seem like a weird miscalculation, because if you want to catch people up on the series, why direct them over towards the 3DS when you're releasing the new one on Switch? I agree. It's very confusing to me why this is not at least coming out on Switch, if not a dual release like they did with Captain Toad earlier this year, where they did it on both Switch and 3DS. It's just kind of odd, and I don't quite know why they did it that way. But again, the 3DS needs games, so eh?
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. We then got one of my favorite videos of the Direct. They announced Splatoon 2 getting version 4.0, but the way they did it... Did you see this, Sean?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you should have watched this, because what they did is they gave it an anime opening for Splatoon. They, like, did a Splatoon-style anime theme song. So, like, an anime theme song, but with the weird Splatoon lyrical device, where they go, rah, 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 that kind of thing. And it had fake gibberish credits and stuff, too. Like, it was, like, a super, like, dramatic anime opening. And they even did, like, the advertiser card at the end that anime has.
Nice.
And it was very funny. They used it to show off some new modes and some new maps. Wonderful video, and Splatoon just keeps on chugging. It is, having this big version 4 update. It is cool that they keep supporting that game for free. There was the paid expansion earlier this year, the Octo expansion, but that was all single-player stuff. The multiplayer content, they continue to add significant amounts of content to that game for completely free. So, if you like, you know, a fun online shooter, Splatoon 2 is still the one I'm going to these days if I just want to play something online. So, yeah, Splatoon. Yay.
Cool.
Yes, they then announced, or they didn't announce this. They reminded us about Mega Man 11, which is coming out October 2nd for pretty much all the platforms, including Nintendo Switch. They were going to announce here that, hey, there's a demo out now because of the earthquake. That got pushed, but the demo had already been out for a week. I played the demo for about 5 minutes on my Nintendo Switch, and it is very cool. It's a beautiful game. It moves really well. It plays very well. It feels more inviting to me than any other Mega Man I've played, so this seems like an interesting game. But we've got that, Mega Man 11. They reminded us about Mario Tennis Aces. It's getting a big update with Birdo, Shy Guy, Koopa, Paratroopa, and Petey Piranha all coming to the game. That's all coming, or starting, September 19th, and I will not be playing any of that because I actually got rid of my copy of Mario Tennis Aces because it wasn't that good.
Okay.
Hey, there's got to pay for games somehow. And I was not going to play that game anymore because I didn't like it. And, you know, I usually like the Nintendo games I buy, but I didn't like that one. It's okay.
I'm sorry, right, Jonathan.
It's okay. Let's see. They then announced a series of arcade classics. Capcom is releasing a beat-em-up bundle, which will include Final Fight, King of Dragons, Captain Commando, Knights of the Round, Warriors of Fate, and then two games, Armored Warriors and Battle Circuit, that had never been on a home console, while also getting released as part of this package. It will include online play, 7 games in total, launches September 18th. So that should be coming out any day now, I guess Tuesday. And that's neat. There have been a lot of arcade releases on Nintendo Switch, and that's pretty cool because a lot of these arcade versions of classic games do not get preserved very well officially. Mm-hmm. So it is cool to see some of that out in the wild again.
Yeah.
But yeah. Let's see. New Super Mario Bros. U Deluxe is coming to Nintendo Switch. This was rumored earlier this month. So this is New Super Mario Bros. U, which was the Wii U launch game. This also includes Super Luigi U and all the DLC. That's coming January 11th of 2019. And I'm kind of looking forward to this one because I did not really play this on the Wii U. I've kind of played it a little bit, but I never got into it. And it does seem neat that they're bringing it over to the Nintendo Switch. I am kind of curious why they're not focusing on, like, Super Mario 3D World, which was the other big Mario game on Wii U. And they just did Captain Toad, which is built off the engine of Mario 3D World. But New Super Mario Bros. Is one of their highest-selling series of all time, so I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, Super Mario 3D World has got to be in the works for the Switch, right? That has to be something that they're still working on.
Maybe. I hope so. Like, I was talking to Thomas about this. We were kind of going back and forth because he's still waiting, and I am too, for announcements of Switch ports of the Zelda games they put on Wii U, Wind Waker and Twilight Princess. And I have to assume those are coming too because I don't know why you would just leave those in the wild. But they are getting to a point where there's very few Wii U games left, like big first-party Wii U games, that have not been ported to either the 3DS or the Switch.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to, like, I think Mario 3D World and the two Zelda games, and maybe that Tokyo Mirage Sessions game from Atlas are, like, maybe the biggest ones left that are still stranded over on the Wii U. So we shall see. They also announced Katamari Damacy Reroll HD. I don't know what this game is. I've heard of the term Katamari Damacy before. I think people like it, but I don't know. It's coming this winter.
Yeah, the Katamari Damacy games are like a cult classic that started on the PS2, I think. That's like a weird, kind of quirky game where you roll up a ball and it's kind of like a snowball thing of you consume things in the environment and the ball gets bigger and bigger until you're like, you know, demolishing whole cities and stuff. So yeah, it's like a quirky Japanese game that people really liked. My impression of the Katamari Damacy series has always been that it was really fun in the PS2 era, and they kept on kind of making the same game, and then it kind of pushed the fans away because they were starting to feel like they were getting exploited, and there are a bunch of like mobile games and stuff. So I haven't seen much from the people who like those games if that announcement made them excited or not, but it's cool that that franchise is not just dead, I guess.
There were some people very visibly excited on Twitter, so, you know, that's nice. It's, yeah. You know, people like getting games ported to Nintendo Switch. We all like it. So there you go. All right. Then they talked about the Nintendo Switch online service. That is launching this Tuesday, September 18th. They had a big video to show off what it offered. Their tagline is more games, more features, more fun. They showed off 5 main features, each of which has a little icon that I assume is going to be rolled into the Switch's UI in some way because they looked like UI icons. So online play for video games, that's the self-explanatory part. That's the main part about this, the same thing as with PS Plus or Xbox Live Gold, is you have to have this to play your games online. Although not Fortnite. Did you see that, Sean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Fortnite will still be free to play without the online service. I don't know if it's that way on Xbox and PS4 and stuff.
PS4 for sure. I don't know how, okay. Because in PS4, their policy is any free-to-play game you can play with a normal PlayStation account. I do not know how Xbox does it. Okay. I'm curious to know for the Switch if that is going, if that is like a, hey, Fortnite is the most popular game in the world right now thing, or if it is a, that's like their policy going forward thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But that's the online play thing. That Fortnite is the only caveat we have so far for that, I believe. They announced they showed off the NES game library again. They're going to be starting on day one with 20 NES games, which is more than they had announced. They said they're going to have a growing library over time. We saw a little bit of the UI. Looks very Netflix-esque. But no mention of Super NES games or other libraries. They announced the Save Data Cloud, which is one of the other features. Automatically backs up your saves to the cloud. The smartphone app for voice chat. And then features for certain games like Splatoon. And finally, special offers for members, to which they only said more to announce in the future and said about. That was weird. They showed off the pricing, which we already knew. 12 months for $20. Family membership for a year is $35. They also announced that they will be selling NES controller replicas, which connect to your Switch the same way as the Joy-Con do, so you can charge them, but they are full-size NES controllers. A pack of them for your left and right will cost $59.99 for a pair of two, and we also learned afterwards you can only buy those if you are a Nintendo Switch Online member from Nintendo.com.
That's a really strange stipulation. Like, why would you not just sell that in a fucking store?
I don't know. I have a lot of questions about NES stuff from the last couple of years. So anyway, Sean, that is the entire online service announcement. You said you found this video very interesting. In what way?
Well, it was just the whole experience of watching it was, at first I thought it's like, oh, this is a nice little well-produced video. I like they had like Mario and like the Mario cast of characters were there and kind of introducing you to stuff. And then you have, if you're watching the Japanese YouTube Nintendo channel, you get a nice Japanese announcer. The English one, I assume you had an English announcer. Kind of taking you through some of the basics. And at first it's like, you know, it still feels really weird to have this service rolled out in the middle of a console. The way that Sony and Microsoft do their account stuff sucks and I don't like it, but at least they like, you know, the 360, when the 360 launched, it was, you have Xbox Live Gold or you can't play multiplayer. Obviously with Sony, it wasn't until the PS4, but it wasn't the launch of a console that they introduced that. It still feels really strange to me that there's like an 8-year-old who's playing Splatoon 2 right now online that 2 days from now will not be able to do that unless they get this subscription. So other than that stuff, I thought it was like kind of putting that out of your mind. It's like, oh, this is a nice, well-produced video. It wasn't until you get a little bit deeper into it where it's like, particularly once you get to the phone bit, and when they start talking about, as a part of this feature, you will be able to communicate with people on your cell phone, was this just like mind-blowing moment of Nintendo feeling like either Nintendo is so out of touch that they literally don't understand that the full original function of a cell phone or any sort of phone is to communicate with people, and therefore you don't need to pay Nintendo $20. You do not need to download their app for me to be able to talk to somebody on my fucking phone, or Nintendo just doesn't know how to justify enough to people that you need to do the subscription that they want to disguise that there's a like another feature in here that you can communicate to people on your phone. But when they like, because it's not, they don't just tell you that you can do that. It's like a 30-second segment of the video of them showing, I think it's like Toad or whoever on the couch, like putting someone on their phone in the Nintendo Switch, like online app on their phone and doing this whole call. And then there's this whole part where it's like, oh, and the best part is, you know, other people in the room can also join in on the fun and talk to other people on your phone. It's like, that's just fucking speaker. Like, that's just, it's just a cell phone, Nintendo. Like, what are you fucking talking about? This is the craziest shit I've ever seen a company try to, like, sell me, is that I can call people on my cell phone if I pay you $20 and use your fucking app. It's literally a phone.
It is strange. I do think the smartphone thing is still the weirdest part of this, because my controversial opinion is, minus the stupidity of the smartphone, I think this is fine. It's not like I'm super excited to now have to pay for online. But look, the bottom line, and I think a lot of people are not saying this. They apparently do not remember this. They are not talking about it. And I mean journalists and people on Reddit, the whole fucking spectrum. Their competition makes you do the exact same thing for three times the price. Like, end of the day, if you remember that the basic functionality of this is to pay to go online with your system, Nintendo did not invent that. It's not really even their choice to do this in the current market environment. It's the way the market is going, and they're doing it for a third of the price. It's not that fucking bad. Like, put all that other stuff aside. Now, within that, is the smartphone thing stupid? Absolutely. Do I wish they were, like, coming out swinging with more than NES games? Like, maybe some, you know, old Nintendo games that people genuinely want to play, like Nintendo 64 and Super NES? Yes, obviously that would be so much smarter, especially because they are doing this weird second year of the console launch for it. Like, we're a year and a half in, and now we're getting it. That's strange. I think it's extra weird that this is launching in one of, I think, the first month of the Switch's lifespan when there is not a major first-party release on the system. So the month of September does not have a major first-party Switch release, unless you count the expansion for Xenoblade Chronicles 2, which I don't think you should count that. Not anything against the game, it's just that's a different sort of thing. But it is strange. Like, I think a lot of people expected that September was going to be Smash Bros. Month, and that this was going to launch with Smash Bros., and so you would have an automatic, that's a game everyone who owns a Switch is going to get, and when they get it, they're going to learn about the online thing, and the game could even come with a 7-day trial, and that's how they would get you online for it. But instead, it's going to be rolling out in a dead month for the console, like one of the very rare down months for the Switch, and I think it's probably going to confuse a lot of people. So, again, I have mixed feelings. I think it's a weird rollout strategy. I think there's some weird things within the strategy. Overall, if you accept the notion, which I don't necessarily, but if you accept the notion that the way things are done in the video game industry now is that home consoles make you pay to go online, this is still way less egregious to me than what Sony or Microsoft do, because it's $20 a year and not 60. Like, much less egregious to me. I guess that is my bottom line. And I guess if we're going to be angry about it, we should also direct that anger towards the people who, like, pushed this system into the marketplace and solidified it as part of the gaming industry, and who take way much more of your money for this sort of thing. I guess that's my overall take on it.
Yeah, although, like, again, I do not want to actually defend the policies that Microsoft and Sony have used, because it is very frustrating. But at the very least, they can, I feel like the services they offer, while they are more expensive, do justify that expense more than, like, the Nintendo Switch. It's one of the things of the Nintendo introducing it, like, a year plus into the console's lifespan, is it doesn't feel justified. And it's something of where, like, it should be very easy for Nintendo to have actually, like, a slam dunk reveal for, like, if they did this the right way and didn't have to lean on some weird smartphone app, didn't have weird and confusing kind of vaguely draconian save policies with locking your save onto your console originally, and then eventually cloud saves are there, and then it's like, but maybe not every game has cloud saves, which is something that came out after the Nintendo Direct, that some existing games at the very least are not going to get cloud save support, and all that stuff is so fucking confusing. That's like, at its core, it should have been very easy for Nintendo to say, we're going to do what the other consoles do, but only for $20, and you get some Super Nintendo games with, like, this good service, and here's, like, the extra bonus deals you get, like you get on PlayStation with PS Plus, and that kind of stuff. And instead, it is this incredibly confusing rollout that makes me look at it and kind of head scratch of, like, what, like, this doesn't feel like a comprehensive service to me, in the way that, at the very least, like, Xbox Live and PSN feel like they set themselves up as, like, we have full in, like, built-in party systems and communities and like storefronts and all this kind of stuff that is more fully developed, where it's like Nintendo feels like it's this weird patchwork thing that they don't even really know how to tell you what the service is, to the point where they don't understand what a cell phone is at some point.
Sure. It's also a third the price. Like, I just...
Yeah, I know.
If it's a third the price and it's also a third of the functionality, fuck it. Because at the end, it is all an illusion. Like, it's not costing them enough to justify this in any of these cases. Like, Steam does not make you pay, like, Steam is horrible, but they don't make you pay $60 a year to play fucking Dota 2 online. It's not necessary to do this. It just fucking isn't. The whole thing is a scam, and I feel like at least if the scam is costing me $40 less, like, I don't pay for PS Plus or Xbox Live Gold. There are some things I would like on both of those. It's just too much money. I am priced out of it. And at least with Nintendo, one, they have more games that I play online, so that's where I'm going to be. And two, I guess if you do count the, like, free games thing, you know, the competing services, I'm going to play the NES stuff more than I ever would the bargain bin reject games they put on PS Plus and Games with Gold at this point. Like, and I think that's true for most Nintendo fans, even if they never expand it beyond NES, which they are. I think that's pretty clear that they're going to do that at some point. Again, it's a weird rollout. I don't entirely get it, but... And no, it is not as comprehensive a service, obviously. Although, again, if we just want to go to the competition, Xbox, with that comprehensive service, also gives you more ads than UI on your UI. So that's nice when you launch your Xbox and you still have an entire page front of advertisements for the Xbox Live Store rather than your fucking games right there. I don't like that. And I guess I don't have as many complaints about the PlayStation, except the UI is still slow as molasses at this point for me. So, like, we did learn... This is an interesting thing. I don't know if you saw this a couple weeks ago. And this might tell us a little bit why they're doing the smartphone thing. Is we learned that the entire UI on the Nintendo Switch, the reason it is so fast and zippy, is that it's less than a megabyte. The entire thing on the system, which for like the Xbox and PlayStation, we're talking, you know, gigabytes of space to put that UI on there. This thing is kilobytes large, and so it's very, very minimalist, but that's because they wanted it to run, you know, more like a smartphone or something and just have it be really, really quick. And I don't know if that's fully justified. I think you could probably find an in-between solution where you could have a party system and a chat system and not make it slow as molasses, but I'm not an engineer. It is, look, it's all weird. You're absolutely right. The you can use your phone as a phone is a very weird advertising model, you know?
Yeah.
I guess just at the end of the day, it's the tenor of the conversation around it frustrates me just a tad in that I think the larger problem is the industry's insistence on charging us for online play, for using the internet we already pay for. And... that's not a Nintendo-only problem. It is magnified at this moment by Nintendo launching it mid-console.
Yeah.
But that's my basic takeaway.
No, I would 100% agree with you there, and it's something of where... It's where it feels frustrating that, like, Nintendo's messaging is so fucking confusing that it is hard to talk about it and not get distracted by, but it's just a fucking cell phone, Nintendo. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, seriously... What are you saying to me right now?
Because I know my brother and I, when we play Smash Bros. And stuff, we're not even going to use that app. We're going to get on Skype or Google Hangouts. It's what we're doing right now. Because it's free and it's easy and I already have it on my phone. And it's not that hard to just do that. So
yeah.
I don't know. Hey, fuck, cut out the smartphone thing and sell it for $15 a year. I'll be even happier. Just
there you
have
go.
A smartphone free option. The version where you can still use your smartphone, just not with a Nintendo app.
Yeah.
All right. Let's also just for a second, the little NES controller replicas they're selling, they seem very nice in a vacuum if you want an NES controller to play those games with. $60 for a pair of two. That is literally the cost of their NES Classic console, which comes with a controller and 30 games. What the hell? That is a weird price point for those.
Yeah, and they force you to buy two of them, right? Because it's
yes.
like supposed to also be the Joy-Con thing. And it feels weird that like... Well, the point of it, obviously, is that it's for the NES Classic games that are going to be on the Nintendo Switch online thing. Like, why not have an option to just buy one for $30?
It's
like,
weird.
Like, you have to buy two.
It's weird, and they also confirmed that right now they're only going to work on the NES games and not anything else on the console, which is bizarre, because I saw a bunch of people saying, oh, this would be fun to play Shovel Knight with, or something like that. And it would. That'd be perfect. But you can't. So, not worth the $60. Just buyer beware. Maybe Nintendo will fix that, but it's a... Because you can also go to, like, 8-bit dough.
You're right.
And they have all sorts of controllers that you can get. NES, like, you can get it an exact replica. You can get one that adds triggers. You can do all sorts of things. And they sell them all with ways that you can use them on your Switch. So you do not need to go through this weird first-party solution here. And those controllers will work with anything.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. So that's the online stuff. It's weird. They then reminded us about Pokemon Let's Go Pikachu and Eevee coming November 16th. They also showed off new Switch console bundles with Pikachu and Eevee-style Joy-Cons and reminded us about the Pokeball Plus. They then had a Diablo 3 announcement. This was, we already knew Diablo 3 was coming. This was going to be the launch date announcement. Again, it leaked earlier because of the whole earthquake thing. But it's coming November 2nd, right in the middle of the video game apocalypse. I do look forward to playing Diablo 3 on my Switch, but I will not be able to do it on November 2nd. And they also said the word hell twice in this segment, which was kind of mind-blowing for a Nintendo thing. My favorite part was they kicked off this, like, without even telling us it was Diablo. They said, the gates to the burning hells will open on Nintendo Switch. Like, the chipper, like, English voice dude. And I just love that that sentence exists in a Nintendo Direct. The gates to the burning hells will open.
That's how they should have introduced the cell phone portion of the Nintendo Switch Online. The gates of burning hell will open in your mind when we try to sell you your own cell phone functionality.
Every time you launch the app, the guy says that.
Yes.
All right.
It is literally just an animation when you load the app of the gates of burning hell opening on your phone.
They showed more of Super Mario Party, which is coming out October 5th. I don't believe they showed anything new. That is a video game. Then we did get something new, which is Game Freak, the creators of Pokemon. They're rare once a decade getting out of Pokemon and making something else. They are making a video game that its working title is just Town, and I hope it stays that way because Town is an amazing, simple title for a video game. It is a new RPG. The entire story takes place in a single village where monsters are invading. It's got very cool cell-shaded art that looks sort of 3D hand-drawn, very manga-esque to me. Looks pretty cool. Coming 2019, this was an intriguing announcement to me. An exciting, different thing from the Pokemon people.
Yeah, it's nice that it feels like there's someone. It's like the Game Freak equivalent of like a jailbreak of just like, can we just get out of here? Like, we're digging the walls. It's like, Pokemon's cool, but holy fucking shit, I'm tired of making Pokemon games. Let's make something else.
Yes, so there you go. That will be Town. And again, I hope that's the title, Town. Let's see, they announced that City Skylines for Nintendo Switch was launching today on eShop, so if you like City Skylines, you can go play that. They showed off more of Demon X Machina, which was the game they showed at E3 this year. More gameplay details about how you can customize your weaponry, you can explore the field on foot as a person, how you level up, that there will be four-player online co-op, still coming in 2019. Looks goddamn amazing. That game still looks fucking cool.
Yeah.
And then we had, let's see, Yoshi's Crafted World. This had been rumored. This is the game that was announced at the beginning of the Nintendo Switch's lifespan, just as Yoshi. We didn't know the title. And now we have the full title, full announcement here, Yoshi's Crafted World. Goddamn, this game looks beautiful. And it's an entire Yoshi game that looks like it's handmade out of cardboard and streamers and markers and things like that. Sort of like a mix between one of the recent HD Paper Marios, and maybe Yoshi's Woolly World, where it's all very handcrafted. You can even play, and you can, like, experiment with, like, moving the whole screen around and, like, explore different parts of it, because you can go, like, under the diorama and stuff. They showed how you can even play whole courses backwards by turning the box that you're, like, playing in around. It'll also have full co-op gameplay. They said this is coming spring 2019. We had heard very good things about this game from people who got to play it at E3 2 years ago. And now we got to kind of see what the game is going to look like exactly. Got a title, a launch window. I am excited about this one. I think Yoshi is having a nice moment right now.
I do kind of wish that they had just called the game Yoshi, like when it was, obviously, like we knew that that was not going to be the title, but there's something cool about the original one they originally announced, both this and the Kirby game, which was Kirby Star Allies, right? That was the title of that game, ultimately. When they just announced them, it's like, it's Kirby, it's Yoshi. I kind of wish they just did it, kind of like how you want Town. I just want Yoshi.
It's kind of like if Nintendo did the stupid naming thing American games are doing right now and just go back to the original title, even though this is like the eighth game in the series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it could just be The Yoshi.
The Yoshi. All right. Then we got a really interesting segment here all about tabletop gaming on Nintendo Switch, where this company is bringing all these tabletop board games to the system as video games, including Carcassonne, the Lord of the Rings living card games, and Pandemic, with a couple more on the way, including Settlers of Catan and Munchkin. I don't know what all those games are, but I will say my roommate here in Iowa has the game Pandemic, and he had some friends over, and we all played that the other night, and it's a cool little board game, and I can see how it would work as a video game, and tabletop gaming has kind of come back into fashion, and this is kind of an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, I enjoy both Settlers of Catan and Munchkin, so...
Awesome.
Those games get thumbs up from me.
All right, Civilization VI is coming to Nintendo Switch. This is launching November 16th. I was not seeing that coming. I mean, it was rumored, so I saw it when we saw the rumor. But before I saw the rumor, because has Civ 6 come to other consoles yet, or is that still
PC
bound?
No, I think it's just PC only.
That's really interesting to me then. Because, again, almost certainly a game like Civ 6 would sell higher on the Nintendo Switch than it would on PS4 or Xbox, I think. It's just that kind of game. So it makes sense that they're bringing it here. I do wonder if it eventually comes to the other consoles based on what they've done for Switch. But we'll see.
I am very curious what, like, the control interface is going to be. Because I have not played Civ 6 specifically, but I played a lot of Civilization 4 back in the day. And those are really complicated games to do with, like, that if you don't have a mouse and keyboard. I think, like, I'm curious to see if they're up to the task of adapting that interface for a Switch. And I think it seems like I assume they would probably use the touchscreen if you're playing portably, because that seems like that would be a much easier way to adapt the UI. But I assume that they would also include if you were playing it on your TV. So I'm curious to see what they do with that.
Yeah, we'll see. Let's see. They also showed off more of Starlink Battle for Atlas. They're really pushing the whole idea that this will have Fox and his friends in... Fox and his friends is a Werner Fassbender movie.
Yeah.
That is not coming to Nintendo Switch. Fox and his friends. All right. Fox McCloud and his friends. They all talk in this video game. It's got voice acting. They also showed off Star Wolf, who is Fox's frenemy or something. And that's coming October 16th. I don't care about this game, but I will say people who've played it at like events are saying it's surprisingly good. So who knows? It's a weird toidled game.
Yeah, I just feel like the Toys to Life thing is so dead at this point. It's been dead for like 2 years, and it's so strange to me that this game is still coming out like that. It feels like they should do something of like, well, you can technically buy the toys, but also it's just a video game. Just get the video game, because the Toys to Life thing just seems like a bad business strategy.
They've kind of said that. It does not seem like this is like Skylanders or Disney Infinity, where it's essential, but it is encouraged. So I'm not sure. This seems more like an Amiibo situation to me, where there were very few Amiibo games that were like all Amiibo all the time. But I don't know. We'll see when it comes out. Then they had an RPG segment. They reminded us about the World Ends With You Final Remix, which is coming out October 12th. They showed off more of Xenoblade Chronicles 2, Torna the Golden Country. This is sort of a Uncharted the Lost Legacy or Halo 3 ODST situation. It is a standalone campaign. You do not need the base game to get it. It's coming September 21st, but in a nice little surprise, if you already had the season pass, they gave it to you the day of the direct, and they just put it out there. So that is out in the wild for people who had the Xenoblade season pass. They reminded us that Warframe is coming November 20th, Just Dance 2019, October 23rd, FIFA 19, September 28th, Team Sonic Racing coming this winter, NBA 2K19 is available now, NBA 2K Playgrounds 2 this fall, LEGO DC Supervillains coming October 16th, and they went through all of that very quickly.
Yeah, it's nice that the sports games are finally like, wait, yes, now we can do the Switch. I feel like that kind of first wave of sports games, they didn't quite all make it there. Now it feels like they're like, get it all on the Switch, boys! Like
all sports all the time.
Football, the other football, hockey probably, we'll put the fucking WWE game on there at some point. Let's just get it all on the Switch, guys.
Then Square Enix had a huge block where Final Fantasy, basically they are dumping every Final Fantasy game they can possibly put onto Nintendo Switch easily, based on what they've done in recent years, on Nintendo Switch as soon as possible. So we are getting Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles Remastered Edition. This was just announced the other day. It's also coming to PS4. It's got new online multiplayer, and they had a very funny line here of no link cable required, because the original GameCube version of Crystal Chronicles was one of those games you had to do the link cable with your Game Boy for. Do you remember that, Sean?
Yeah, like the Four Swords Adventure and those kinds of games. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, they've got that. That launches 2019. They also showed Final Fantasy 15 Pocket Edition HD, which was the iPhone version of Final Fantasy 15 with chibi characters. That is coming to Switch. It's also going to PS4 and Xbox One. I don't get the Final Fantasy 15 Pocket Edition thing.
I feel like Final Fantasy 15 Pocket Edition is, like, secretly one of the weirdest things Square Enix has ever done, and I don't understand. Like, I feel like I don't understand what Final Fantasy 15 is anymore. Like, it has, like, a multiplayer thing in it now. It has a fucking cell phone version that's weird. It has chibi characters. Like, what the fuck is that video game now?
It's a game that cost an unreasonable amount of money, and they're trying to make that money back by doing whatever the hell they can with it. I think that's it.
That you're probably right.
Like, not because the game didn't sell well, it sold very well, but it cost too much money, and there's no amount of sales that would have made that money back.
It's almost like even less than money, and it's just, like, the time cost of, like, the fucking 10 years or whatever that game was in development. It's just like, we have to do something with it, I guess.
Alright, they also showed off World of Final Fantasy Maxima. This is a port of the chibi Final Fantasy game that was on PS4 and Vita 2 years ago, I believe. It's coming to Nintendo Switch. And we are also getting an HD remaster of a game from 2007 that I did not know existed called Chocobo's Mystery Dungeon.
Okay. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. I didn't know that game existed, but it makes sense if it's a Mystery Dungeon game.
Yes.
Like the Pokemon Mystery Dungeons and all those.
Yeah, because back in the mid-2000s, there were all those Mystery Dungeon crossover games, like the Pokemon ones you just mentioned. So I guess this was the Chocobo one. And there was a small but vocal subset of people who were very enthused by this announcement.
I'm sure. You know, people like those games.
And then, just as we thought the Final Fantasy section was over, it kept going. And Final Fantasy XII, The Zodiac Age, the HD remaster of Final Fantasy XII, that's coming to Switch in 2019. And I thought, that's awesome. I haven't ever played Final Fantasy XII. I don't have the PS4 edition. This is perfect. I would love to play that on my Switch. It seems awesome. And then they said other iconic classics and showed off the PC ports of Final Fantasy VII, VIII, and X and X-2 HD are also all coming in 2019. These are the same PC ports that also got put on PS4 over the last couple of years. They're very good, polished ports of the original PlayStation versions. And as a lot of people pointed out, it is just very cool and surreal to know that we will be able to play Final Fantasy VII on a Nintendo platform when, back in the day, Final Fantasy was the most famous defection from Nintendo over to PlayStation. Yeah. So,
well, it's like I didn't read enough of it to get like the full sense of the scope of it, but it seemed like there's a reason why Final Fantasy VII had not been on a Nintendo console before, and like there was like legal stuff tied up with Sony of like
exclusivity
stuff that only very recently went away. And so I think that's part of the reason of like, hey, Final Fantasy VII can be on other consoles, because it could be on the PC, it could be on PlayStation, but it couldn't be anywhere else. I think Final Fantasy VIII was maybe the same situation.
Yeah, well, 8 is not 8, because 8 is not in, it's not gone to PC either.
Okay.
Yeah, 8 is, or the other consoles, it's 9 is the other one they're doing.
Oh, 7 sorry.
And 9. No, it's okay. People were pointing that out, because there is that small group of crazy people who think 8 is a good game. But yes, I'm excited to have 7 on my Switch. I have never played that game all the way through to the end, but every couple years I kind of try to pick it up again. Yeah. And the furthest I've ever gotten was on Vita, like with the PS1 Classics, because it is a good portable game, and it'll be really nice to have on Switch. These are also coming to Xbox One, I should say, so Final Fantasy is also getting over there, which is cool.
Because now they legally can do that. You should look online, because there was a really interesting article about it that I kind of had scanned, because I didn't have time to read it all the way.
And as my brother Thomas pointed out, he said something to the effect of, hell must have frozen over, because Final Fantasy VII is coming to a Nintendo console before that remake is ever coming out. Which
that
is
remake
very
is
true.
Never coming out.
Yeah, you know what, like, we didn't talk about this this year much yet, but do you think that remake will ever actually happen at this point?
It feels that, like, we should have seen something more of it. I think it will, I do actually think it will happen, but there's a part of me that, like, in my heart, I'm like, nah, fuck that. That's never happening. I think we will get Final Fantasy VII Dirge of Cerberus on the Nintendo Switch before we get Final Fantasy VII Remake. I think. And then we'll get that weird Final Fantasy VII game that was, like, released only on old Japanese flip cell phones from, like, 2005 or something. There's that whole period around Advent Children where they made a bunch of Final Fantasy VII spinoffs. All those will be on the Nintendo Switch before we get Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with that game. I think it may come out. I don't think it'll be for the PS4 generation. I think that's a next-gen game if it comes. Maybe cross-gen, but we'll see. It is one of the games I did in my furious pre-order blitz on Amazon for, like, getting the 20% locked in. And I'm just like, this seems extra wishful to put this on the list, but they're not going to charge me anything right now, so fuck it. So I do have a pre-order of that game. I feel silly for it, but I do have it.
There you go.
That
it's
is
definitely
almost...
coming out there. If you can pre-order it, that means it has to come out, Jonathan. You can't pre-order something that's never going to exist. That's just crazy.
That's almost like it would be irresponsible corporate practice to do that.
Yeah, but, you know, corporates always have our best interests at heart, Jonathan, so you don't have to worry about it.
All right. They also showed off a new Nintendo Switch bundle for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. That launches... This is kind of weird. It launches November 2nd with all the, like, Smash Bros. Stuff in it, like the Smash Bros. Themed dock, and the Joy-Con will be Smash Bros. Colored. But the full game is as a download code in the box, and it'll basically let you preload the game, but obviously you cannot play it on November 2nd. They are also launching all the GameCube controller stuff, like the dock, on November 2nd. Not a month later with Smash Bros. I there's no problem with any of that. It's just a little weird. But yeah. That's coming. And then they said, all right, we're done for today. We're going to show you one more thing. And then I loved this line because it was such a perfect setup to what came next. They said, please stick around until the very end. And then Nintendo gave us maybe their best, like, cocktease announcement they've done recently, which they've done a lot of these. Animal Crossing. We had a scene with Isabelle, everyone's favorite Animal Crossing character. She's only been in one game, but people love Isabelle. And she's thinking about how the mayor is busy being off at the camp and playing Smash, and she wonders if she should be the mayor instead, then decides against it. Then she gets a card, and it says, they want me in Smash, and there she is. Isabelle is a playable fighter in Super Smash Bros. It's a really cool fighter announcement. We learned in the time afterwards on the website, she is not an Echo Fighter of Villager. She is a new, fully featured Super Smash Bros. Character. And this did seem like just a great tease because we thought, oh, they're going to announce Animal Crossing for Switch. And no, it was just Isabelle. And then just when we think we've been completely trolled, it faded back in. And Tom Nook is at his desk. And he's tired. And he turns his light on. And he sees that Isabelle has joined the fight, and he grumbles about that because he's got other business to attend to. And he has to make sure that everyone has a nice new home to live in. He has to get back to work on Animal Crossing 2019. Duh.
And that was it. Motherfuckers.
Yeah. The game we all knew they were going to make, they're going to make. Yeah.
There you go.
I will say, there was this like weird thing in the Nintendo community over the last couple of months of acting like, well, since they haven't announced it, clearly they're never going to make another Animal Crossing game. Like, so many people were so weirdly pessimistic about Nintendo making Animal Crossing, even though it's one of their biggest series, and obviously it wasn't going anywhere. But it was nice to see it confirmed. It would have been particularly trolly to do the Smash Bros. Announcement and not confirm that they're making Animal Crossing. But this does confirm that 2019 is going to be insanely stacked for Nintendo, because they are going to have the new Yoshi, the new Fire Emblem, possibly Metroid Prime 4. They're going to have Daemon X Machina. They're going to have Animal Crossing. They're going to have Pokemon Gen 8. Like, I actually don't know how they're going to space all this stuff, because it's going to be a crazy year, especially if on top of that, I mean, we're going to have all these Final Fantasy ports, and we're going to have the new Super Mario Bros. U Deluxe, and I assume more ports beyond that. So, yeah, Switch is going to have a big 2019.
Yeah, yeah. I'm happy for Animal Crossing fans, because it was something of where... Because I think part of like why the community was so weird around a new Animal Crossing was they felt so like, as someone who is not an Animal Crossing person and only observed it from the outside, it seemed like they were very jilted by that mobile game, Pocket Camp. It was like, I remember the day that Pocket Camp game came out, because I follow a lot of games people that are fans of Animal Crossing. They seemed like, oh yes, oh, this game is awesome. And then like you could like measure like, 24 hours later, almost exactly, everyone's like, nah, that game's fucking bullshit and is ruined. Animal Crossing, everything's terrible. It was like, there was such a, like, immediate harsh reaction to that game after people had a little time with it and, like, I get probably engaged with some of the, like, the more bullshit mobile stuff in it. And so I think that is where... Because it's just, like, people who like Animal Crossing are the nicest people that like video games. And so it's just, like, it felt something where it's, like, their faith was crushed for this weird little moment from that game. And then now they're all happy again on Twitter, and that makes me happy.
It is. I am glad. Animal Crossing signifies, if nothing else, joy. So it is good that Animal Crossing fans can be joyous again. And I almost shudder to think how big a deal Animal Crossing on Switch is going to be. Because it is, like... the ultimate perfect system for Animal Crossing. Like, if any game was ever made for Nintendo Switch, it is Animal Crossing. And I'm a little terrified. Because I remember just when, like, the 3DS game came out, and that game came out early in the 3DS's lifespan. We weren't even at the point yet where the 3DS was a huge monster hit. And I remember being on campus at CU Boulder, and I have never seen that many 3DSs out in the wild of people playing Animal Crossing. It was like every class, people were playing Animal Crossing. I didn't know there were that many 3DSs out there. And the Nintendo Switch is a bigger hit. And
yeah.
I think it's another one of those games that if you own a Switch, you're probably going to get Animal Crossing. I sure as shit am. And I feel like this is going to be like like the world's Dragon Quest in Japan moment, where like economic productivity is just going to fall off a fucking cliff when Animal Crossing comes out, but for the entire world.
There is a certain aspect of, like, you know, Animal Crossing has a lot of that sort of mobile game, kind of like real-time stuff that sort of like psychologically pressures you to try to play the game, which is why I didn't like doing it when I think I had the GameCube one, and I kind of walked away from that game because it fucked with my head and I didn't like that. And so there is a little bit of a, like, maybe this is the end of mankind, is Animal Crossing on the Switch, and it's just like 20 million people or whatever, how many people on the Switch at this point, like, that whole section of humanity is just gone. It's like The Leftovers or something. It's just like that. Yeah. We'll have to deal with the aftermath of everybody who owns a Switch no longer being a part of society.
They've all gone to live in Animal Crossing.
Yes.
It is going to be a trip, but there you go. That was the Nintendo Direct for a, like, you know, mid-fall kind of random Direct that was, I don't think anyone expected was going to be that big. It was an interesting little event. A lot of news, not a ton of new stuff, but the new stuff there was interesting, and again, that Animal Crossing thing was a master troll. And also, I gotta say, I don't know if any group of people have ever been more spoiled than Smash Bros. Fans are being by this new video game.
Yeah.
And, like, that Isabelle announcement was, it was a troll to the Animal Crossing fans, but it was also like, if you throw us any more bones over here, you know, Masahiro Sakurai, we're gonna die from eating all these bones that you're throwing us. Holy crap, this is a lot of Smash Brothers.
Yeah, I do like also the trend in Nintendo Directs now, that this is the second Nintendo Direct post the E3 Direct, which is better than the E3 Direct, and makes you look at it and be like, why wasn't half this shit in the E3 Direct?
Well, a lot of it was, because they kind of repeated it here, but yes, this was definitely a more effective presentation overall, but yeah. Yeah, they decided ultimately that E3 would be the one where Masahiro Sakurai would get super granular and technical about the most minute changes to Smash Bros. Ultimate, when they knew full well that they had much more exciting announcements about that and every other game in their back pocket. But hey, you know, Nintendo got a Nintendo.
Yep, they're gonna try to sell your cell phone to you for $20 a year. They're gonna sit you down for 30 minutes and lecture you about, like, different voice takes in fucking Super Smash Brothers.
Here's a question, Sean, about the online thing. I know we gotta move on to Spider-Man, but do you think there's any chance, given how successful the Switch is, if this online thing does work for Nintendo, like, people sign up for it, the show keeps going on uninterrupted, which it could be a failure. Like, let's be clear, like, the asking people to pay for Splatoon 2 a year and a half after Splatoon 2 comes out, could result in significant backlash.
Oh, if any company's online service is going to crash and burn, it is going to be Nintendo. There's no, like, I'm not saying that will happen, but I think that is on the table in a way it was not when Sony introduced paid online stuff at the beginning of the PS4 generation. That was never going to destroy them.
I agree. But I was just going to ask, so that's a tail possibility. The other tail possibility in the bell curve is, it's successful and, like, it's a big thing for Nintendo. Do you think there's any possibility it pressures, like, Microsoft or Sony to lower the price of their online offerings
at
all?
No. Okay. No.
I think Sony won't. I think there is a tail possibility Microsoft will at some point to try to be more competitive.
I think, Microsoft is so desperate with so much stuff. There is a chance there. And if Microsoft does it, then I think it could pressure Sony. I think the more likely scenario is that Nintendo eventually makes it more expensive on their next console.
I think that's probably what's going to be happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's just the $60 thing for online has just been instilled for so long.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
All right, let's go ahead and move on. Before
we move on to Spider-Man, there is one other piece of news that I forgot to mention to you that I want to talk about very quickly.
Let's spend much time on it.
But there was the Nintendo Direct, and while you're talking about the Nintendo Direct, I remember there was another video game thing that happened, because you got your Nintendo bullshit, I got my bullshit in my corner, which is TGS happened, the Tokyo Game Show. I don't know if you followed any of that, Jonathan, or not.
I did not.
Yeah, there was only, like, there were two major announcements, only one of which was particular interest to me. The other one is they're making a new Samurai Showdown game, which is cool for people who like fighting games. Samurai Showdown always seemed cool, but I'm not a big fighting game guy. If it doesn't have Goku in it, I don't play it. Or if it doesn't have Spider-Man in it, I don't play it. Those are my two fighting game rules. You got Goku or Spider-Man or both, I'm fucking playing that game. Otherwise, I forget about it. But there was an announcement that is very much, since the last year, is a part of my camp, which is the Yakuza team announced their new game, which is not a part of the Yakuza series, although seems like it is maybe exists in the same universe. And that's this game called Judge Eyes, or Judgy Eyes, Shinigami no Yuigon, if you watch the Japanese video, because it's very good. The way the dude says the title of the Japanese video is fucking beautiful.
So and Shinigami is death god. What's no Yui? What is it?
Shinigami no Yuigon. It basically means, like, prophecy of the Grim Reaper, something okay. like that. Yeah, so, but Judge Eyes is, like, the main title of the game. I've seen some people calling it Project Judge. That was its project name, and I don't know why people are still using that. They've announced the title as Judge Eyes here. And they basically released two, like, six-minute videos. One is a story trailer, one is a gameplay trailer. I highly recommend people watch both of them, because they are both endlessly fucking entertaining, because it is 100% the Yakuza style. The story trailer is so fucking melodramatic and over-the-top, and the setup of the story is you are this lawyer at the beginning of the game who's, like, the best lawyer in the world, and you just won this, like, miraculous case that you got this guy off of a charge that, like, you think he was innocent, and you got him, like, you know, innocent, and he's fine and out there. It's, like, amazing. Everyone thinks you're the, like, most amazing lawyer in the world that you got this guy off this murder charge, and then that guy kills again and, like, burns down this house and kills this family of people. And so then you're, like, and I think I it wasn't 100% clear, because I only watched the trailer in Japanese when it went up, really, like, shortly after it went up. So I think maybe one of the people he killed was connected to the main character. Anyways, it then, like, cuts to way later. So that's, like, the first, like, 3 minutes of that trailer is this long scene in this lawyer office detailing all that shit as these lawyers are talking to each other. And then, like, way later, the main lawyer dude has been disgraced. He's left his profession and become, like, a down-on-his-luck private eye in Kamurocho in Tokyo, in, like, the fake district from the Yakuza games. And so then he's, like, going around and, like, tailing people and investigating crimes and, like, taking pictures of politicians going into love hotels with young women and all this shit. And then he starts kung fu fighting people. When you start watching the gameplay trailer, he has, like, nunchucks and shit. He beats a dude up with a dildo at one point. And it's, like, it gets the full range of the Yakuza games, but it's also you are a private detective instead of a ex-Yakuza dude in Kiryu. And it is just the best fucking shit. The main character is also played by Kimura Takuya, who is a, like, huge actor in Japan that's in, like, every, like, television drama, like, super successful television drama. He plays, like, the main characters in a bunch of that stuff. So it's a huge get for the Yakuza team to get an actor that huge, and it's, like, his face and likeness and everything. That game looks fucking rad as shit, and it is out in December in Japan, and there's no announcement yet for when the localization come out over here. And there's a very good chance I'll just have to play it in Japanese, because the fucking trailers are so good.
I think you absolutely should do that. That can be your December game, since you don't have a Switch and won't be playing Smash Bros. And that can be in contention for your top 10 list. And you could just have a bunch of Yakuza games and Yakuza adjacent games. I'm excited for this listening. You tell me about it. Because I now am thinking on the horizon, I could play a game by this team and learn what they do so well without having to play seven Yakuza games.
Yes, it is nice to see them, like, being able to go to a wholly different area, because it very clearly is, like, founded in the Yakuza 6 stuff. Since I just played Kiwami 2, it very much looks like it's that engine, but them being able to experiment when they're not, like, specifically latched to just Yakuza, that's really exciting to me. And it's just cool to see that team. It feels cool to see that, like, there's an audience over here now for what that team makes, because Yakuza 0 was such a big cult hit last year that there's a lot of excitement in different corners of the gaming community now for what this team does, from me, and it's really cool to just see that turnaround and see them be able to make something that is completely disconnected from Yakuza, but people are still super excited about it over here. It's cool. Yeah,
absolutely. So that sounds awesome. All right, you want to talk about Spider-Man now?
Now we can talk about Spider-Man.
All right. last spoiler-free reactions, I guess. Do you want to give, like, a quick summary of, like, what your final thoughts would be in spoiler-free fashion before we get into the main review?
Yeah. This is... Let's start with, like, the very easy statement of this is the best Spider-Man game by a country fucking mile. And there are... I think my main statement when we did my impromptu, like, weird, like, top eight Spider-Man games that I had played or whatever it was podcast a while ago was there are quite a few, like... pretty good Spider-Man games that are like, yeah, that's good, and that's like the level that Spider-Man games hit, and there's never been a great Spider-Man game. This is a great Spider-Man game. This is a must-play game.
I would actually say that calling it the best Spider-Man game feels like damning it with faint praise.
Yes, it is. I will say for me, this is the best superhero game. I think you can make arguments about the different Arkham games in this, and it kind of, some of that goes down to personal preference. For me, this is the, like, you know, the kind of like watermark or whatever for superhero games at this point. It is built with so much love and passion for the character and the source material, but also with this really brilliant understanding of what that source material is and able to build on it and provide this very unique, specific vision of what Spider-Man is that is not, it's not Insomniac trying to make the Ur Spider-Man the way that Rocksteady was making the Ur Batman in those Arkham games that was like, everything about that take on Batman was very familiar, and there's something very beautiful about how familiar it was because it's pulling from the animated series and the greatest comic book stories and all those other interpretations of the character. So all that was very familiar. Here, Insomniac is providing a very specific kind of evolutionary take on the character and saying what happens if we build Peter Parker from the ground up today, but also set him basically where he's at in the modern day Spider-Man storylines in terms of his age and his situation of being post-college graduate and all that kind of stuff. And so they're able to build their own Spider-Man, and that allows them to tell what I think is just an amazing, really affecting, really powerful Spider-Man story that, particularly when you get to the last act, everything comes together in such an incredible way, in a way that I was honestly really taken aback because Insomniac is not a studio I have personally a huge amount of experience with, but their reputation, while it is really good, is not necessarily for big narrative-heavy games. The reputation is built off of Resistance and Ratchet and Clank more than anything, and Spyro if you go back in the day, and those are all kind of gameplay-first games and like aesthetic-first games, not story-first games. And Spider-Man, I wouldn't say is necessarily a story-first game, but it, like, the story and the gameplay and the aesthetic all combine and have, like, equal weight to me and build up to this, like, really powerful game that in its final moments, I rewatched the last 30 minutes of the game on YouTube, like, twice today because I just found them so powerful and so effective. And I think, you know, the whole story builds so well. The gameplay is incredibly effective at making you feel like Spider-Man at every moment. It has a tremendous amount of variety. The web swinging is great. The combat is phenomenal. And all the gadgets and the way they handle the gadgets are amazing. And then I think one of the brilliant small touches is all the moments you get to touch on other characters in the world and see other perspectives and build this whole tapestry. And it is not just Spider-Man's story, but it is Spider-Man's story and Peter's story and Miles' story and MJ's story and all of them coming together. I think it really is just a whole next step for what licensed games can be in video games.
I think it's a next step for what video games can be. Again, I would go beyond the licensed game or superhero game or Spider-Man game boundary that we're setting for ourselves here. This is just a great video game. I think it is the best Western game of 2018 so far by a country mile. It is an amazing, amazing accomplishment. I agree with everything you just said. I think the story makes choices about what it wants to do with Spider-Man and his universe that are bolder than anything we've gotten in adaptational superhero media maybe in my lifetime. It really makes, like, other than maybe something like Spider-Man 2 or The Dark Knight, something that, you know, really just is a watershed in its own, I would put up with those works as a true watershed moment for this character and for the superhero genre as a whole. And again, outside of that, I think it is such a masterclass of game design, of open world game design, how you can use things like collectibles in a video game for good and not for evil. A great example of just storytelling and technical acumen all coming together. And if you're going to say this is the best Spider-Man game and the best superhero game, I'll do you one better. I think this is the best first-party PS4 exclusive for me. Like, of games that open with Sony Interactive Entertainment at the beginning, I think this is the best one so far. Again, we're not counting, like, The Last of Us, because that's a PS3 game. We're not counting Persona 5 or something, because that's a PS4 exclusive, but not a Sony game. Of the Sony games, God of War, Gravity Rush 2, Uncharted 4, I think this is a cut above even those amazing games we've gotten so far. And I really do think it is a special accomplishment. And the biggest praise I can give it is that from buying this game to platinuming it, I did that in 5 days. That's the fastest I've ever platinumed a game. And it's not because this game is short and light on content. It's because it is so good and propulsive and quick on its feet that I could not put this fucking thing down.
Yeah, and I still want to play it. I want to play it right now. I wish I was playing it at this moment. It's just like...
I am looking forward to the DLC, yeah, because it will give me more to do.
Yes, it's... I think I said it last time, and it still has not changed. Like, this game is in my head, and I'm just thinking about it constantly and thinking about, like, the rhythms of the game, both in terms of the story and in terms of the gameplay and the movement. It is a really remarkable achievement. And you are right that it is not just a remarkable achievement for its genre. It's a remarkable achievement for the medium. And it is like, you don't need to like Spider-Man to like this game. If you like games, you will like this game.
Yeah, I just don't want to get into the trap that I have seen a lot of video game journalists getting into over the last 2 weeks, which is they're ghettoizing this game. They're saying, this isn't a game, it's a superhero game. This isn't a game, it's a licensed game. And, like, for those things, it's so good. And I think that is selling it so massively short to only look at it through the lens of games we consider bad. You know, like, that is so damning it with faint praise. You know, it's like saying, this is pretty good for a horror movie. The thing people always do, like, critics do with, like, horror films that are good. Like, ignoring that there are plenty of really great, like, groundbreaking horror films. I just don't want to fault, like, I'm not saying you are. It's just, like, I want to remember that, like, this is so much more than a moment for superhero games. This is just a great fucking video game.
But it also, I think part of where, like, that instinct comes from, at least for me when I phrase it that way, is there is this element of it being, like, fucking, what if we could do this with all the other stuff?
Oh, yeah,
like,
totally.
What if we could have Avengers be this, and an Iron Man game be this, and a Captain America game be this, and, like, just for the Marvel characters? And, like, what if we could have Star Wars games that were like this again? Because Star Wars games used to kind of be like
but
this.
But that's why you have to treat it as a game, because the reason why Batman Arkham and Spider-Man are the best 21st century superhero games is they are the only ones that were made as video games first and licensed products second. They weren't existing to sell other Spider-Man or Batman media. Like, they are in an ancillary kind of way because it's all connected, but this movie did not come out to promote Spider-Man Homecoming. Arkham Asylum did not come out to promote The Dark Knight. Like, these games were made as video games, and that's the key. That's how you do a successful adaptation, is you don't treat it as, this is good for the ghetto it's in. It's, let's make a real video game. And they made a real Spider-Man video game, and that's what's so exciting.
Yeah, and it just feels like Marvel gave Sony, and more importantly Insomniac, like, the keys to the kingdom.
Oh, yeah.
With Spider-Man. It's just like, fucking just go at it, guys. And because they get to, it's very clear, they got to do whatever they want with this game. Like, they got to make the game that they wanted to make and tell the Spider-Man story they wanted to tell. And you are right, that is 100% the most important thing to do, is to give a really good developer carte blanche with really evocative material.
Speaking of evocative material, spoiler warning! There will be spoilers. Stop the podcast. If you have not beaten Spider-Man on PS4, there will be spoilers in 3, 2, 1.
Peter Parker is Spider-Man. Holy shit, Jonathan. I just never... It makes so much sense when you say it, but I just never put it together that they're, like, never in the same room, and Peter's always taking pictures of him. Amazing to me. This blew my mind.
And the scene where they reveal that, the one where Aunt May dies, tragically... It's just astonishing.
Well, there you go. You just said the real spoiler.
Yeah. Yeah, that was actually my idea, but I think you had a better one in there. Yes. I guess I can't not start at the end with this, Sean, because it blew my fucking mind that they went where they went, not just with the Aunt May stuff, but, like, with everything tied into it. Like, when Peter is on the side of the building talking to Doc Ock, and it's just like, you know, I worshipped you, and you hear Yuri Lowenthal, like, shouting this line out, and I'm, like, tearing up, realizing, Jesus Christ, I've never been this invested in the, like, relationship between a hero and villain in one of these fucking things. And then Aunt May fucking dies. The ending of this game is bonkers. They went places with the end of this game.
Yeah, and it's something of where, like, I had been really enjoying the story up to that point, and I had liked particularly all the stuff they did to really characterize the world and you know, characterize Peter and MJ and make it feel more fleshed out than just he's Spider-Man going around beating people up.
Yeah.
But, like, there was some stuff about it and some, like, the characterization of Peter and stuff that I felt, like, a little bit off, or, like, you know, I didn't know if I was fully invested in that, like, take on the character until that end. It felt like it brought everything together and kind of, like, it stripped some of the layers away from that their version of Peter Parker to, like, get more at, like, the angry, vulnerable kind of character that I think Peter Parker is at his core that you don't see as much in this game. And there's something about them, like, bringing that all at the end that had such a tremendous impact on me. Like, again, I had to watch the ending multiple times, again, on YouTube just to, like, get myself prepared for this conversation because it really is incredibly powerful.
It's jaw-dropping stuff to see all the places they go at the end of that game. And I don't know if we want to zero in on that now. It's just, I had to get it out of my system and say the words, they killed Aunt May. Because I know this is not the first time in all of Spider-Man media that Aunt May has been killed in one way or another. But
no.
This is pretty obviously permanent. I do not think they're going to do one more day in the next video game or anything.
No, yeah, that would have been a very different end credit scene of Peter encountering the literal fucking devil and making a deal to, like, make him forget MJ or something so Aunt May could come back to life.
Yeah, that would be terrible. They did not do that. I do think just the way they tie together these strands at the end of the game of Peter, Dr. Octavius, Mary Jane, Aunt May, and Miles Morales, like those five key pillars of this game, and how integral they all are to the thematic tapestry that I think shows its full hand in the final hours of this game, it really is stunning. And I think this is a game that is not only good throughout, and it is, if it had a terrible story, it would still be a fun game because the gameplay is nailed so perfectly, but it is such an amazing on-point blend of gameplay, aesthetics, and narrative, and the way all of that comes together near the end of this game, it's staggering. I was not expecting this Spider-Man game to be... I was expecting it to be really good. I was very excited for it. I did not expect it to be this transcendently good and ultimately this powerful.
Yeah, because it's something of where... Like, part of, like, the ghettoization of this genre with video games is that, like, the storytelling is historically very poor, if not non-existent for, like, you know, licensed games. Is either you're, like, just telling the story of the movie in a very compromised fashion, or it's just, you know, something like Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions that just has the most thin, fanservice-y story to it that isn't really much of anything when you get down to it. The only exceptions to that are the Arkham games. And even then, they have some issues with, like, I think it maybe is part of the issues with, like, the character and my personal taste is, like, those games don't represent, like, the scope of the character in, like, the hero, and they're not really trying to. They're kind of being more of, like, an individual graphic novel or, like, a movie, whereas the Spider-Man game feels like it is representing the heart of the character by showing, like, this feels like I read, like, 30-something issues of a Spider-Man comic, and it feels like... You know, obviously it is tied together and it has an overall arc, which is how comic books are written these days, is you do have, like, big multi-issue arcs that are, like, nestled in one another. But it has, like, a, you know, the overall beginning, middle, and end, but it also shows you all the in-between moments and fills it with all the little bits of characterization and humor and life and tonal, you know, variety that you get from a more serialized format like a comic book. And I think, like, just the structure of the game is so smart in giving you both the, like, classic Hollywood three-act structure thing, that there is a very clear act 1, 2, 3 in this game. In fact, I think the trophies literally call them that. But also within those, there is all this little extra story and all these extra moments that humanize everything that, like, video games as a whole, as a medium, typically have a very hard time finding the space to spend time with characters and just sit with them, especially in an action game. And Spider-Man takes every opportunity it can to either switch the point of view to another character that's not Spider-Man, or have you spend some time with Peter, or even just have Spider-Man do some mundane, normal stuff like what he does at all the Harry Osborn research stations. And not every single mission for Spider-Man, not every single day Peter puts on the suit is a day where he goes and beats up the Rhino. Sometimes he goes and he, like, tests the, like, water in, like, the coast for pollution or whatever, you know, or he goes like, you know, distributes an antidote with some to some fish that have been affected with something. Like, that's the part of his life and part of being a superhero also. And I think there's something so incredible to me about this game being able to show you all of that, which is something that no other superhero game has ever done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with all of that. There are many ways we could go in this discussion, and I'm probably going to let you lead it because my voice is dying and my mind is going. But I did, before we get into just a full gush session on all the things we love about this game, I want to list like the very few criticisms I have and hear if you have any.
Okay.
Just so we can like be constructive criticism, and then we can gush as much as we want. Sound good?
Sure, yeah.
All right. I have two. I don't think the boss battles are that good, and I think the use of Riker's Island and associated imagery is extremely problematic in the year 2018.
Yeah, like, that's, I kind of agree with, well, I don't as much agree with the boss battle one. I think they could have been a little bit better, or like, almost like more evenly distributed or built up in some ways. I think they could have like developed them more, but I didn't have any problem with them. I enjoyed all the boss fights.
So here's my thing. I think there are two boss fights I really liked, and they're the two Sinister Six team-up fights. So the one where you fight, it's Vulture and Electro together, and the other one is Rhino and Scorpion. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yes. I think those two are great, because the problem with every other boss battle in this game to me is that the whole combat system for Spider-Man, which again, I think is maybe the most brilliant gameplay thing in this entire video game, is the combat system, is built around fighting lots and lots of enemies all at once, and being on the edge of your seat trying to do a million things at once, and, you know, constantly making quick, fast decisions. And when you get it down to just Spider-Man versus one big bad guy over here, you strip out so much of what makes the combat system special, and every single one of those fights that is not one of those two-on-one team-up fights ultimately is dodge the big attack, dodge the big attack, either throw something at them or web them up and then move in for the kill and hit, and then repeat two more times. And it's just very cookie cutter. It's really repetitive. Most of the boss fights feel like the same thing. They're not bad. I don't think they're bad as in like they are like annoying to play. I just think they're fairly dull. And again, I am someone who my default position is boss fights in video games are bad. Unless it's a, like an RPG or something. And I mean JRPG, like with a combat menu where like you don't have to radically change what you're doing to have a boss fight. I think in first-person shooters and in third-person action games and all this kind of game, I think boss fights are usually bad. That's my personal opinion. They can be good, though. I think those ones where you have two-on-one are so much better because it requires, like, there's more space that you go swing around. You have to deal with two people at once. It much more reflects the basics of the combat in the game. I do think the final battle with Doc Ock is creative in that you have to fight, like, you have to hit all of his arms, so there's more of a varied goal going on. But even that one is so easy to, like, figure out. I didn't find it that interesting. So again, this is not, like, a unique problem to Spider-Man. It does not ruin the game for me in any way. I just noticed it, especially because the last third has so many boss battles once you have all the escaped convicts. And the two where it's two-on-one stood out to me because I'm like, these are great. These are really fun. And then the other ones were pretty dull to me.
Yeah, like, I think I enjoyed the boss battles more from a narrative point of view than a gameplay point of view. But it's like, it's almost just kind of like in a Yakuza space for me where it's like, the Yakuza boss fights are not fun because there's some, like, you know, Mario-esque mechanical puzzle or whatever associated with them. They're fun because they're built up really well. I think that's where, like, I really enjoyed the Doc Ock fight at the end from just purely from a narrative perspective. Like, I could have beaten that boss fight with my eyes closed at some point because it was, you know, nowhere near, like, the difficulty of, like, a, you know, Sable outpost or something. Like, you've done way more difficult encounters at that point in the game. But there's, like, such a narrative momentum behind it, and there's such a sort of, like, cinematic spectacle to that you are playing with in, like, kind of an Uncharted fashion of actually fighting Doc Ock, but it's just so spectacular looking that I just get very easily swept up into the moment with those. But I agree that I think there could have been a balance of building some more, like, slightly unique mechanics around the boss fights and maybe, like, having a couple more of them in the middle or something that develop whatever that mechanic is in a more traditional video game boss fight design kind of, like, philosophy.
Like, this is an area where I think the Arkham games do something unequivocally better than Spider-Man, which is the Arkham games have very good, memorable boss fights. They do a lot of different varied things with them. I think the combat system of Arkham adopts to boss fight encounters more readily.
I actually disagree with that. I think Arkham has a couple of really good boss fights, or like it's specifically Arkham Origins has a couple of really good ones, and Arkham City has the Mr. Freeze fight. I feel like outside of that, Arkham has like a lot of really bad boss fights in it that are like more what you're talking about with like the Arkham system is very much also a lot of different opponents. And so whenever you have something that's not like the Scarecrow levels that are more like this very unique take that's almost like hard to even technically call a boss fight, whenever it's like the end of Arkham Asylum when you're fighting a big Joker or whatever, those always suck to me. Like I thought
that one's horrible, but yeah. I generally like them in Arkham. I don't think they're all great, but I replayed those games last year. And I do generally, the Joker one's awful, but the end of Arkham Asylum is awful. So I don't know. Anyway, we can move on from this one.
Yeah.
All right, my other complaint was the Rikers Island.
Yeah. Like, I definitely don't disagree from... Because I think it's been interesting, as someone who is in the space of, like, the last 2 months read about 260 issues... No, it's more like 280 issues of Amazing Spider-Man plus Spectacular Spider-Man. So I have, like, very much superhero genre tunnel vision. It's been really interesting to see a lot of people and like Twitter and video games talking about like the cop stuff in this and some of the Rikers Island stuff. Is it definitely not a wrong criticism, but it's something that like I had a very hard time seeing because it is so a part of this genre. It is so like embedded in like the superhero stuff that it is hard for me to like sometimes take a step back and be like, I mean, yeah, no, it is so fucked up the way that like when you really think about it, the way you do the law enforcement stuff. And there is specifically in 2018, it feels more a bit like tone deaf, but it didn't, I have to be honest, like it didn't really impact me that much while I was playing the game.
I'm only talking about the Rikers thing, to be clear. The other criticisms I've seen of that, like the cops are all nice and it doesn't get into police brutality issues, I don't care about. I don't mean I don't care about police brutality. I care about that a lot. I don't think this Spider-Man game is the place to tackle that. And I think if Spider-Man wants to be a fundamentally optimistic thing, which it is, in a world where maybe the cops can just be good in this world and we can like leave that complexity aside, I'm okay. It's fantasy. Not all stories have to be and represent all things, and they can't. Like, I'm not sure where in this game you would do the story of like Spider-Man deals with cops shooting unarmed black men or something. Like, that would just so fundamentally alter the tone of this game, because then you also start have to bringing in all the vigilante stuff and all the like genre underpinnings that if you really interrogate any of them, you can't do the genre. Like, you just literally can't, because it becomes all deconstructionism and it's all meta-narrative and it's all too morally complicated to get into. So it's not that those aren't important issues. They're unbelievably important issues. I just don't necessarily think this is the game to tackle them in. It can be big and broad and comic booky. And that, to me, is the problem with Rikers, is you can be big and broad and comic booky, which this game is in Spider-Man's relation to law enforcement and criminals, but then you bring in Rikers fucking Island, and it's like, Rikers Island is not big and broad and comic booky. And I understand that, like, there's a history in comics of using the term Rikers Island or something.
Yeah.
But, like, this is an institution in New York that is so toxic that the state of New York is shutting it down. They are phasing out use of Rikers Island within the next 10 years. Like, this could not be a more current thing. And it is really distracting to be swinging around New York and having fun as Spider-Man and doing this kind of big, broad narrative that is more personally focused than it is socially focused, and you're fighting your criminals, and then like they have Rikers on the fucking, you know, like the inmate clothing that they have, and you're like, oh god, I'm sending these guys back to be just horribly psychologically and physically abused. Like imagine if it was this game and Spider-Man went to Cuba and he was fighting Gitmo detainees. Like, it would be, that would be exactly the same level of ugh. Like, because it would be so easy to just make up a fake prison, which is weird because there already is a fake prison also in this game that they could have just used for the whole thing.
I mean, the thing is that, like, because, again, reading all the comic books, like, Rikers Island is just the prison that they have always used in Marvel Comics going back to the 60s. So it's like, in my head, it's not Rikers Island, Rikers Island. It is like weird Marvel Universe Rikers Island, where there's like a clear divide between good and evil, and there is no complexity in the nature of crime and the nature of justice, you know? And there's, it, like, you are definitely right, and they should have switched it. But it is why, like, for me, it is hard for me to like say Marvel's Rikers Island and real world Rikers Island is just not associated in my head. And it's just like, because I've been reading these comics since I was a kid. It's like, they should have done a thing, which they actually, there is a very brief line if you beat the Black Cat's side quest line in this game, where they reference this, where in the Marvel universe, Marvel Comics universe, there is no Mafia, there is the Magia, and that is their, like, fake name for that. And they should have done that with Rikers or something. They should have just, like, done whatever, you know?
So yeah, I see what you're saying. It's... Like, I suspected that was the case, that, like, this was a thing from the comic books that they took, that the use of Rikers Island. It just does seem... I guess if I have any reaction, it's that a game of this size had to go through a lot of people to get to store shelves, and that was a lot of people who apparently did not object to the use of, again, like, American Gitmo in... I mean, Gitmo is American. You know what I mean. Continental Gitmo. And I just... It surprises me more than anything else. It's... I just think it's irresponsible imagery. That's all.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, those are my complaints. Did you have any other, like, issues with the game that are worth noting before we continue gushing about it?
This is actually, like, a criticism I don't know how much is really a criticism or is just like, I wish there was more of this game, because it's definitely something we're going to get in the DLC. But I do wish that there were a couple more sort of more developed side mission quest lines in the middle of this game, because they have the one where you fight Tombstone, and I like that one a bit, because I like Tombstone. He's a good, fun, he's a very good C-level Spider-Man villain to put in that situation in a game like this. And I wish there was a little bit more of that stuff. At the same time, like, there's a chance that it would be too distracting from the main story, because I like how focused the main story is around Mr. Negative and Dr. Octopus. So it's like, again, that one is like, it's hard for me to parse if that is actually a criticism of the game or just my wanting more of the game, and I'll get that when we get the Black Cat DLC and all that stuff. The other thing that this is, like, a very minor, petty thing, but there's a couple of suits that are not in this game that I so wish were in the game, and I know we're getting 9 more because we're getting 3 with each of the DLC packs, so there's maybe these will be in there at some point. And I know that the symbiote black suit is not going to be in this game because they want to save that for the story stuff. I think they should have just had it in the game anyways, even if they aren't doing the symbiote. You don't have to have the symbiote story to have the black suit in the game. It could just be a non-canonical thing, whatever, because all the other suits are non-canonical. The black suit is, like, easily by so much the most recognizable and iconic alternative costume for a superhero ever. It just blows my mind that the black suit is not in the game. Again, I get the narrative reasons for it, but I just think you could have just done it anyways. And then there's a couple of others, like the Future Foundation suit, which is fucking rad, and that's not in the game. And there's the other Ben Reilly suit. And it's just, like, some of the suits that are in the game, I think they rely way too much on the big spider armor stuff and the big glowy bits and, like, the big shiny armors. And that's just, like, my personal taste is I don't love Spider-Man in the Iron Man armor kind of looking stuff. And so I think there was a different... I wish there was a slightly different distribution of the suits. Again, very petty complaint because there are, like, 25. A bunch of them I fucking love. I love the Scarlet Spider one. I love the Vintage comic book one. There's a bunch of them that are awesome. Like, Spider-Man 2099 is obviously a classic that needed to be there. That kind of stuff. And it's a way better representation of alternate costumes than any other of these kinds of games I've ever had. And you don't need to get the fucking Best Buy pre-order DLC to get the 70s Spider-Man or whatever, you know, that would be the equivalent for the Arkham games. But there are a couple that's just like, you didn't quite hit my Spider-Man suit, and I wish you did.
I get it. Although, again, there are more than enough Spider-Man suits in this that are really good to satisfy me. There's enough that, like... We'll talk about this later, but, you know, I said last time that I did play around with the different suits a lot during my main playthrough, particularly at the point in the story where you've gone to the raft and everyone's broken out and everything's gone to hell, and then Spider-Man gets out of the hospital and has to, like, get back on his feet and go back out, and now he's a fugitive. I decided, all right, this is a moment where, you know, he got torn up to hell at the raft, so I'm going to switch his suit and make a new, like, canonical suit for me through at least, like, near the end of the game until I'll have a dramatic moment where he'll put the main suit back on again. And I picked the one that... It's the one where he's in the leather jacket. What's that called?
The Last Stand suit.
The Last Stand suit.
That is such a good fucking pull because it is from a, like, very short Spider-Man story from, like, 2003 or 2004 where he sees like a, he gets seen shown a vision. I think it's Doctor Strange shows him a vision of an alternative future where what if Peter went bad and started killing people and like kind of went down that choice. And that's from that future where he has like jeans and this dope fucking leather jacket and these red riding gloves and this cool, it's such a, it's one I would never have occurred to me to put in the game, but it's so good. And it's probably my second favorite of the alternate suits in the game.
It's definitely my favorite alternate suit. I just fucking love it. And so from that point on in the game, once I found that one, I basically made that my default for most of the game up until like the moment where he's going to go fight Doc Ock. I went back into the main suit. But other than that, like I mostly used that one because it felt so good for like a Peter Parker who's like become like an outlaw and he's kind of trying to stay under the radar now. And it's just, it's so cool. Like the leather is all like, it looks so real in the game. It's like so perfectly molded graphically, and I love the jeans, and it like it works in cutscenes really well. Like every one of these does. Like they're so fully integrated. Like those amazing cutscenes, which do not look like in-engine cutscenes, but they are in-engine cutscenes, and so it like uses all these alternate suits so perfectly. But that was one where it's like this perfect melding of silly alternate costumes, and it weirdly worked with the canonicity of the story for me. So I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. The suits are awesome. They just, yes. They really should have put the Future Foundation suit in it. It's very cool. It's all white. It's very cool. All
right. Let's see. Where do you want to go next with the game?
Yeah, because we talked a lot about the swinging and the combat last time. So I don't know. Do you want to like dig into that stuff again? Have your thoughts on that side of the game changed at all? Is this the last time that you would add?
The only thing I would add to that, because I think we did a pretty good summary of the traversal and the combat mechanics, I will add to that. This is how you know the combat is good. There is a significant difficulty spike when you get to the third act of this game, like post the raft stuff, and you get all the new Sable stuff, which is the hardest material in the game, and it only gets better from there. Like, the more they throw at you, the more fun the combat is, and that to me is the ultimate test of any kind of combat system in any game, is it more fun the harder it gets? And if that's a yes, you've made something masterful. And I think that is absolutely the case with the combat in this game. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah, 100%. That is a really good point. Because, I mean, obviously, also, I'm the guy who played it on the hardest difficulty from the start. So it's like, I'm the, like, push it to the limit. Let's see how hard it can get and, like, how far it can push me as a player. And there are some games that can do that and work with it well. There are others that can't. And this is a game that, like, on the harder difficulty, it just gets better and better, and you are 100% right. My favorite part of the game in terms of playing it, and specifically for the combat, was that last act where the city kind of goes hostile, and you get the particularly the Sable outposts, where the Sable enemies are by far the toughest enemies in the game. They have so much shit they can throw at you, but you can also, like, them throwing shit at you kind of gives you ammunition to throw it back at them, because it's like, I love you can, their grenades are the best grenades to throw back at people. The other ones are like, it kind of does a little bit of damage. These ones, like, if you throw your grenade at me, I'm going to throw it back in your face, and it's going to really fuck you guys up, and you can't use all your stuff, and I can web you and everything. So I think, yeah, like, the balance of how the enemies change and evolve over the course of the game, and particularly once you get to that Sable part, really does make the combat shine even harder. On top of that, the last time we talked, I just remembered, I had not hit the challenge side quest line yet. Like, I was right before that unlocked for me, where the Taskmaster is doing his weird shit and is like, I'm going to...
Yeah, I had started doing that already. Yeah.
Yeah, so I hadn't done any of those yet, and that is some of my favorite stuff in the game. That's one of where I'll put another, like, minor criticism, is I do wish there were some more of those, because I like them a lot.
I wish those were easier to access. I think there should be like a menu within the menu where it's like you can just scroll through challenges and like pick one and it'll fast travel and load you into that, rather than having to go back around the city and like find the individual boxes again. That later on, because I was trying to get some challenge tokens to like unlock my final few things, and I agree, it's fun to do the challenges again and try to like get your best score and stuff. I think they could have made it slightly more user-friendly just as a thing, especially in the end game.
Yeah, I'll agree with that, because, yeah, it is, and that would have been nice, to, you know, in a very, like, Arkham challenge room kind of thing, if, like, they both existed in the open world as a thing you could access, because obviously the levels are in the world, but having, like, just a menu option to do them, that would have been nice. But one thing that, like, I feel like there was this moment when I did... the first one of those that was the traversal ones where you have to follow the drones, because I don't know how you played them, Jonathan, but whenever I did one of them, I did it until I got gold on it, and then I didn't move on. So I got gold on all of them, which you don't have to do the platinum. I did it anyways.
I did not do that because there are some I would never get gold on. They're really hard, some of these. Like, I did get at least 2 stars on all of them, and then I had to go back and get 3 on a couple to get enough to unlock everything. But, like, some of them are... Like, the combat ones wound up being the easiest for me to gold star. There are some that I just never even figured out what I could do to get a higher score.
With all of them, it's basically time. Like with the combat and the stealth and the drones, it's about how quickly you can do it. So it's not quite like the Batman one. There's a little bit more of how many different things can you put into this combo and stuff, and can you keep the combo going. And Spider-Man is all about, for the combat ones, how quickly can you deal with this scenario. But the one that, for me, like, kind of evolved part of my understanding of the game was when I hit that first drone challenge one. I think it was the first one of these I did at all. Like, I didn't have done any of the combat or, like, stealth or the other options or, like, the bomb ones. And I hit... I think maybe there was a bomb one, because I think maybe that's, like, the first one you have to do for the story. And I think I went back to that one to gold it, because I didn't... Again, I didn't know how, like, all the side quest thing worked yet. And so then eventually I hit the drone one. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get gold on it. Because it's kind of like what you're talking about, Jonathan. I don't want to have to go find this one again later if I decide I want to make it gold. I'm just going to do it now. And I spent, like, probably... It felt like an hour. It probably wasn't an hour. It was probably more like 20 to 30 minutes, but it was just felt like I'm spending a lot of time doing this challenge, and because, you know, each one is only like 2 to 3 minutes a go through, but it felt like, so I just did it a bunch and it felt like it took forever, but I learned so much about the traversal system in just sitting down and being like, fuck it, I'm not fucking leaving until I get this goddamn gold. And by the end of that, I felt like my understanding of how to, like, game, like, accelerate in the game and maintain momentum changed so much. And, like, because I got golds actually pretty easily on the other drone challenges, I think, just because it's like, it's so much about you just building up the skills to manipulate that system. And it gave me, I already had a huge amount of respect for just, like, the raw game feel of the swinging in the game, and the like, not just the swinging, but the whole traversal like system that they built, because it's a lot more than just swinging on a single web. But after I did that, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the amount of just, like, mechanical variety there is there, and how much depth there actually is in trying to optimize something like that, because it is so much fun. And by the time I got to the end of that and was getting a gold on it, like, I was just fucking flinging so far across and just, like, diving super fast, and then doing, you know, like, a little tiny swing that I let go without jumping to slightly alter my trajectory, and then a big swing with a jump at the end that launched me over, like, 3 buildings. There's a lot of shit you can do with that game when you get more experimental with the traversal that is so much fucking fun. And so then once I got to the Silver Sable part, I was just hauling ass across that city like a maniac, and it felt so cool to have gone through that and, like, really changed my understanding about how to play the system. And it wasn't just fun in games anymore. It was like, I feel like I can get across the entirety of Manhattan in, like, 4 minutes or something at this point. It's so fucking cool. So I recommend people to, like, you know, you don't torture yourself to do it, but I think going for gold on some of those really pushes you to understand stuff about the mechanics that just playing the main campaign is never going to force you to do.
Challenge modes are always good. They're a fun way to get better at the game.
Yes, it's a lot of fun.
Let's talk about, like, so we just talked about the challenges and we talked about the Sable outposts. This is an open world game with a whole array of things to do in it. And this is something we really didn't talk about last time because it gets into spoiler territory, because they're constantly adding new things onto the map. And I think they're expecting that you're going to be playing a lot of it as you go. So, like, for me, I did all the backpacks and all the Black Cat stuff really early on. So by the time they rolled new stuff into the game, it was, like, perfect. Now I have more to do as I'm swinging out between things. And I saw someone today on Twitter dismissing this game. It was, like, a game journalist. As, like, it's got good traversal, but the rest of it is an Ubisoft-style collect-a-thon. And I cannot disagree more with that notion. I don't even like referring to this as a collectathon, because it's not. It has a lot of things to do on the map. The only genuine collectible thing is the backpacks, which you could do in, like, half an hour if you wanted, like, because you can move around this game so frickin' fast. But I really, as I said, I could not disagree more. We talked about last week that it's got this brilliant system where you just hit in the right thumbstick and you just see in your vision, not even on the mini-map. I mean, it's on the mini-map, but you don't have to look at it. You don't have to look at your map screen. You can see all these things that are out there to do. And the goal for me is it's trying to make you feel like Spider-Man. And Spider-Man is a guy who's out there in New York, and he's got a million fucking things on his plate. Like, all right, my main mission is I have to go over to Dr. Octavius' lab. But while I'm heading over to Dr. Octavius' lab, there's a crime over here, and there's a crime over here, and there's a person who needs my help in a side quest over here, and there's this backpack I found over here, and aw shit, Black Cat's up to some stuff over here, and now there's an outpost over here. And I think that array of things to do, one, it gives you so much to do with that traversal and with the combat system, and it is really varied. This is not like an old Assassin's Creed game where you have 10 different versions of the feather, and it's mostly just like, get your animus tokens, and get your feathers, and get your this sort of thing, and this sort of thing. It's not that at all. I do not think this is like a collect-a-thon game. It is an open-world game with a lot of things to do, and there is a checklist. But I think the way it actually functions in terms of gameplay and flow and how it augments and supports the narrative works much more substantively than an Ubisoft game does.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you, Jonathan. I think it's... And I get that like different people have very different tolerances for that kind of stuff, and some people just don't want to do it at all and just don't... They have like some sort of like built-in thing at some point, or just some learned behavior from having played too many Assassin's Creed games of the, you don't want to ever collect anything in the game ever. And I get that, you know, there's personal taste in there. But I was kind of surprised at how, after reading some of the reviews, that was the general opinion of most of the reviews, was that that side stuff in the collectibles was too much and it was the weakest part of the game. And it's, I'm not going to say it's the strongest part of the game, but it is so built in to the world and like the feel of traversal and just like the, I mean, just the basic mechanics of existing in that world and navigating that world. It just gives you little things to do that are not interruptive, that are not like ridiculous. And it's not like, you know, compared to the number of collectibles and different little doodads and random like tiny side missions in Assassin's Creed 4 or 3 or like 2 or like, I mean, any of them basically past 1. It's like nothing, because you also, it's not as many as those games, and you move at such a ridiculous pace. Again, you can move across the entirety of Manhattan in that game in easily under 10 minutes. You can traverse the entire like length of the whole fucking map. It is not hard to get around. You can move across the map faster than in like any other open world game I can think of, other than maybe like a Spider-Man 2 that has a similar kind of thing, because it's a smaller world in Spider-Man 2 than what Marvel Spider-Man has for their Manhattan. And so having all those collectibles, it is not a... It never felt like I was, like, imposed upon by the game to be like, oh, I have to get all these fucking collectibles. I had all the backpacks in Landmarks done before I even realized I had done all of them. Like, it was just... I at no point in this game did I sit down and say, well, now I'm going to, like, I have to go do collectibles and open up my map and put a waypoint here, swing over there, get the waypoint, open up my map, go to, like, put another waypoint on another thing. I never once in the whole fucking game did that. And I do that in a lot of games I play, because I, you know, played a bunch of the fucking Assassin's Creed games. I have a generally pretty high tolerance for that kind of bullshit. In this game, it never felt like bullshit. I just did it while I was doing whatever else I was doing as Spider-Man.
I agree so completely, and that is the key point. Does it ever feel like a chore? And it did not feel like a chore for me, as I agree with you completely. There was no point where I sat down and I'm like, let's go find these things to do. It was, I'm going around, what things are there for me to do? Because it's really fun to go around the open world, and yeah, these are not like just go pick up shit. Like, the backpacks all have a cool little item in them, and Yuri Lowenthal has a line as Peter Parker where he describes the object, and so there's like this little reward there. The landmarks, there are only like, what, 12 of those? Like, there's not a ton of those within the entire game, and you can just do those literally, you don't even have to stop. You just swing by the thing, and he'll pull out the camera in midair and do it, so that's a fun thing to do. And then you've got all these combat challenges and stuff that you're going around doing. The only part that ever wound up being a chore for me in any way is when I had finished the game, there were still some like crime encounters I had, and I had to just go web around the city in those areas until I had all of them done. And I'm using the word chore very relatively there because it only took a little bit of time. They auto-cycle those through every, like, 30 seconds. They're really fast to do. There's not constantly stuff interrupting you on those. And so you can clean all of that stuff up very fast. And, again, you never have to open your map to figure it out. It just happens out in the world. So, and again, like, I platinumed this game in 5 days. And I did play it very quickly, but I doubt I put more than 30 hours into this game. That's the other thing. Like, this is a fairly svelte open-world game. If I 100%ed, like, Assassin's Creed 4, which is a game I love. I love Assassin's Creed 4. That would take, like, 100 fucking hours to sail around that entire world and go find every little thing and go to all the different places, because traversal is a chore in most open-world games, and it's not a chore here. Like, God of War was the same way for me earlier this year. I love God of War, but when it got to the end game and I decided to platinum it, by the time I'd found everything at the end, I was fucking sick of it.
I don't know if you can hear me, but you have frozen on my screen.
Really made for backtracking traversal the same way a more traditional open-world game is. So, again, in terms of things we call a chore, I don't think Spider-Man falls under that purview in any way, shape, or form.
Jonathan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, sorry, you froze on my screen for a little bit.
Were you still hearing me?
No.
Oh. Well, I was saying it's not a chore, and I really like it, and I made some comparisons to Assassin's Creed 4 and God of War, and that those games are much harder to traverse because the standard open world game does not make traversal this easy or this fun.
Okay.
Respond.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And so much of it is about movement speed and just being able to fucking book around that world super fast. So much of it is just about also, I think, tone. And I love that I love, like, both that there is a very kind of, like, bright tone for long sections of the game, and also that, like, the tone shifts. And there's something really compelling about that that, like, keeps the open world feeling fresh. Again, it's one of those things we talked about last time with the way that the time of day changes and everything with the story instead of being a day-night cycle. It's one of the things that helped the open world stay very fresh and engaging to me is that as I went through the story, the world changed. And there wasn't just, like, a... Like, when you do the towers at the beginning part of the game, which is, like, the first 15 minutes or something, I just swung around and got all the towers. When you do those, they don't just vomit every single activity from the whole game onto the screen at once the way that, like, the classic Ubisoft tower model does. When you do them, you're probably doing them at the very early part of the game, and there's, what, like, the backpacks, the landmarks, and the kingpin hideouts, and maybe the black cat stuff if you haven't gotten there yet. So there's four different kinds of activities, or three different kinds of activities that populate the map. And then there's the random crimes you hit while you go. And so you have that kind of, like, baseline, but as the game goes on, they add the different kinds of outposts, they add the challenges, they add the research stations, they add the side missions and the other activities that then start populating that world. So it isn't this, you can't just, like, boot up the game, go to a tower, and then just complete every fucking activity in the game and spend, like, you know, 12 hours at the beginning of the game just doing all the side shit and then get to the story. They dole it out as it goes along, so I think it helps the pacing feels fresh constantly with the side stuff, and it blends the side stuff with the main story, so you're never just in that space that I have definitely been in these games and burned myself out on a game like Watch Dogs or something, where I hit this point in the game where I feel like I have only been doing the random side shit for like 12 fucking hours because I can't move more than 2 feet in this goddamn video game without encountering some other random bullshit. And then when the problem with that game was then eventually when I did do a main story mission, I hated that also. So then I had to stop that one. But here I'm constantly flowing between all the different kinds of side activities and the main story. And then I love that the main story gives you little tiny pockets of space to say, like, here's a point where the story is on pause for a little bit and you can go do whatever you want. And it sort of, like, solves a little bit of that, like, open world urgency problem that is such a thing of the world is falling apart. Well, why would I not just immediately go to the next main story mission? And it's like, well, the next main story mission isn't there yet. Or it's like the next main story mission is going to be, you know, a thing that, like, pushes the time forward to the next day. So even when that mission unlocks, it doesn't feel very urgent. So I think there's a lot of really small little choices that Insomniac made across the whole game that solves those problems. And while it is not trying to revolutionize the structure of the open world, and I think, like, it is definitely in the mold of the classical Ubisoft tower open world thing, it is incredibly impressive to me that a studio that has never done a game in that model does a game that is in that model and does it better than almost any other game I've seen that does it. Maybe than any other game I've seen that does it.
again, if you are a longtime listener to this podcast, you know there's no one more allergic to stupid bullshit in open world games than me. I was fed up with these fucking games back when they were like, you know, like in the when GTA 5 was coming out and everyone just could not lavish enough praise on useless bullshit in open world games. So I'm really sensitive to this stuff. I probably liked Assassin's Creed Origins less than a lot of people, the newest Assassin's Creed, because while it's very good and very fun, it still ultimately suffers from the Jesus Christ, this game is so big and has so much to do, and at a certain point, it's homework. It's not a video game. Spider-Man is not that kind of thing. It feels like a focused experience, even when it is open and giving you a lot of toys to play with. And I think that is the magic trick of the best open world. And this is kind of a smaller open world game than, you know, a Witcher or something. I feel like now we're at a point where we have to say open world RPG versus open world action game, because they're all different kind of things. But as open world action games go, to me this is, like, near the top of that crop, for this very reason.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, I have beaten the game and I still just want to swing around, and I spent hours yesterday after I finished the game, platinumed the game, again, got like all the challenges, all the gold stars on everything, like I did every optional thing. I never beat a hideout that I didn't do all the optional objectives, like all that stuff. I did everything in that game that you could basically possibly do, other than I think there's like 5 hidden photo ops I have not done. So I've done 45 of them, and I'm almost there, and I will do them at some point, probably when the DLC comes out. But I still want to just play that game right now. And I'm not going to, because I should move on to Dragon Quest XI. But I could spend another hour tonight just swinging around in that open world, doing some random crimes when I want to, listening to a podcast or music. Like, it is so relaxing and fun to just exist in that world and engage with the basic fundamental mechanics. And it's, like, I think one of the most important things about Spider-Man is it is such a mechanically rich open world game that is also a mechanically rich AAA game, and I feel like a lot of times that's not the case. A lot of times you have like mechanically light or mechanically very simple games that are in this kind of genre, and Spider-Man does not back down on that shit, and it just like piles on and gives you a bunch of gadgets, a bunch of powers, like a bunch of like little modifiers you can do to put in the suits, those little suit mods, and then like gives you some like really truly challenging material, particularly when you get to that last section of the game and the Sable stuff and getting gold stars on all the challenge maps is actually difficult and forces you to really engage with the mechanics on a deeper level than most of the games ask you to do.
I agree 100%. This game is, like, to me, as much as I love the story and what we're going to talk about, I am most impressed by the mechanics side of this, because I have seen great superhero storytelling before. I don't think I've seen superhero gameplay this all-encompassingly great. And that's not to put down something like the Arkham games, which are fantastic in so many ways and surmounted their own challenges, but they're just not this level of, like, Jesus Christ, I love just the basic movement of this game. How many games can you say that of, like, the act of walking in the game, or in this case, webbing in the game, is so undeniably pleasurable? It's a rarity, and I think this game really nails it. And, you know, I still think, weirdly, there's kind of a difficulty in video games criticism in fully engaging with the mechanical side of a work as a significant artistic thing. And I think we all should strive to, like, focus on those things, too, because that's what, you know, game-making ultimately is, and this game does it so spectacularly well.
Absolutely. It's amazing, yeah. Some might say.
It's an amazing Spider-Man game. All right, so let's go ahead, but not one of those amazing Spider-Man games, like the shitty...
No, yeah, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is not a very good game, even if you amazing only Spider-Man get it for, like, 10 bucks.
Amazing Spider-Man 2, not an amazing Spider-Man game. Marvel Spider-Man, an amazing Spider-Man game, but not an amazing Spider-Man game, because that one was not amazing.
No, but you will become an insomniac when you're playing the game, because you just can't put it down. There you go. Put that on the back of the box.
That would have been great on the reverse cover art. They should have totally done that.
Just put the cheesiest possible reviewer quotes on the reverse box. Like the box art on the reversible cover is amazing, but the fucking reviewer quotes are some shit.
They should do that with the next Spider-Man game, do a parody of that Game of the Year cover that Arkham City had back in the day, where it was like a million critics quotes, but have it all be bullshit, like not any real critics quotes. All right, so we've talked about the gameplay. I think it's time to talk about the story, and I think maybe the best way to break down the story, and you can tell me if you have a different idea, is going through those 5 character pillars here of Peter, Mary Jane, Miles Morales, Aunt May, and Dr. Octavius. Because, again, I think those five characters and the interactions between them are what ultimately define this game as such a great thing. And I think you could also throw in Mr. Negative in there if
Martin
you want
Lee,
to.
Yeah.
Martin Lee. Although he's not as part of the core cast in that way. But yes. Where do you want to start? We talked a lot about Peter last week. Do you want to pick up with anything on that?
I've just to like sort of reassert, because I don't remember everything we said of, I think it's, well, actually let's pick up something I said earlier about like one of the things that at first was a little bit of a quibble for me that I don't think I mentioned on the last podcast because it's something I was mulling over, is the characterization of Peter Parker. Because in this game he is, it feels like it's a little bit of a takeoff from Homecoming, even though it's not, because the timing wouldn't have worked out for that, but because they're both in production at the same time. But both Homecoming and this game have these real, like, kind of sweetie pie Peter Parkers, you know? They're, like, just the most adorable, nicest people in the world, and you just want to pinch their cheeks, and it's like, because he's not just Spider-Man. He's Spider-Man. He's working with, you know, Otto Octavius, who he doesn't know is going to be an asshole and a supervillain at some point later in the story, but things is like, I'm really working to help people, and I'm helping invent, like, really advanced prosthetic limbs for people who have lost their limbs, because, you know, we all saw what happened when Dr. Connors tried to find a biological version of that, and he became the Lizard, so it's like, let's go back to the mechanical side, but make them really fucking dope. That's probably the better path than injecting yourself with Lizard DNA. Turns out, neither path maybe is great. Maybe just, like, maybe don't do the Neuralink cyber mega arm that turns into a giant spike, or inject yourself with Lizard DNA. There's maybe a happy middle ground somewhere in there. But yeah, he's working to, like, help people with the science and getting paid nowhere near the kind of money he would make if, with his talents, if he was at, like, Oscorp or somewhere else, doing something that is less sort of, like, ethically beneficial for the world. And he also, on top of that, volunteers at the Feast homeless shelter that Aunt May works at. So it's like, he is the best person in the world. Like, he is so sweet and so nice and so adorable and always trying, and this is true of both him as Peter and him as Spider-Man. And, like, he's that more than maybe any other version of Spider-Man I've seen, because even Tom Holland's Spider-Man Homecoming version of Spider-Man has a little bit of that teenager flakiness to him and the need to prove himself. That's kind of his character motivation. And this, since Peter is older and, like, more advanced as Spider-Man, there's this certain amount of him that's just like, this motherfucker's a goddamn saint. And I like that characterization, but it kind of bugged me a little bit for a lot of the game, because for me, Peter Parker as a character needs to have a certain amount of edge. He needs to be this guy that has, like, a temper, and he can be very angry, and he can lose control of himself because he's, you know, he's this very tortured person that, like, holds himself up to such a high standard, and such a high standard that he can never really meet. And so there's a tragedy to that character and an anger to that character that always really appeals to me. And it was felt a little bit missing in this game for some parts, but the deeper you get in, I feel the more they start pulling back that kind of armor that Peter has, and this, like, kind of a certain form of confidence that he's built up in this game, that even when he's really low in sort of the middle parts where he's been evicted and stuff, he's still taking it more in stride than, like, the Peter Parker in the comic books I'm reading right now would not be as smooth about it as this Peter Parker is. But once you get to the end and you start, like, sort of really stripping him back and making him really vulnerable and go through some, like, truly horrifying and harrowing experiences and having to face up to what Dr. Octopus has become, or Octavius has become in becoming Dr. Octopus, there is, I think you, like, get that edge back in Peter Parker, and he sees that maybe, like, sweetie pie Peter Parker is too much of almost like an overcorrection, and it's like he's maybe a bit too naive, and he's maybe, in his naivety, has let this scenario get worse than if he had been that Peter that has more of an edge, that Peter that is a little bit more angry and a little bit more, almost has, like, a sort of, like, self-righteousness to him that is more part of his other characterizations. And in here, he's let himself be so, like, consumed by this positivity that he can't see where Dr. Octopus is going. And he's not able to do anything about Norman Osborn, who is the real enemy behind all of this that Spider-Man is not doing anything to help with. And that is the thing about Peter Parker in this game that surprised me the most, was that the things that I felt at first were like, I think maybe this, like, version of Peter is a bit too positive. He's a bit too, you know, up on this stuff. He's a bit too, like, there's no rainy cloud over his head. that was more of a feature of the story than I ever had expected. And when you get to the end, it feels like they're really sort of, they've set up a really interesting character arc for future games also of what does Peter do now that maybe he's lost a little bit of that faith that he had because of how far Otto had fallen. And I think that's just such a, I was not expecting that at all from this game. I was not expecting that level of sophistication in tackling the Peter Parker character at all and doing it in a way that I've never seen before in other Spider-Man media. And it's something that helps this Peter Parker feel distinct and a very specific take on the character that I enjoyed a lot.
I agree with all of that. And to bring another character that we need to talk about into this, I think Mary Jane and his relationship with her seeds a lot of what you're talking about through the game. And I think it's there before you as an audience, as a player, as an audience member, even really picks up on it, that what it's doing in exploring their broken relationship and the issues she has is it's shining this light onto Peter's, kind of what you're saying, his relentless positivity, and that it's not necessarily just a good thing and he is like Saint Peter or anything like that. Because the ultimate reason is you kind of get to get the feeling as you go through all the Mary Jane stuff is that he is more patronizing to her than he realizes. He's not really ultra supportive of her sort of being her own person and taking her own risks because he constantly feels like he needs to be the hero. Other people cannot do heroic things. He's got blinders on for heroism that is not like him or a police officer or something like that, that is just obviously out there in the field fighting the bad guys. And I think the Mary Jane stuff, which is maybe the most impressive part of this game to me from a narrative level, because that is such a hard character to evolve, and I think the specific evolution they've done here is so ludicrously impressive. But I think by the end, especially when she starts really calling him on this shit, it's a very good setup for the fall that's going to happen at the end of this game, which is that none of this is that Peter's a bad guy or he's doing it out of malice, but I do think part of the whole point of that stuff with Mary Jane is these blinders he has on to the limits of his own power, to the potential of other people in his life, and to kinds of heroism that sort of go beyond his own, and that he does have some definite, like, maybe ego problems in there as well. And I think, again, I agree with you completely that if there's any point where it feels like this is light or maybe a shallow reading of Peter Parker, I think Insomniac knows full well what they're doing with the character, and they're guiding the ship in the right direction.
Yeah, and it's an impressive reveal in some ways, because it's not really a reveal. It feels more like, oh, this is just a very sort of like standard, straightforward, kind of like, you know, non-complicated take on Peter Parker. But you're right. Once you get into some of that MJ stuff is where they really start seeding it, and it's a good little, like, you just, because, you know, this takes place months after they have broken up, and there's never that one conversation where they actually just lay it out. There's actually that, you know, this is where that great Stan Lee cameo is that I just love, is right at that moment where MJ asks Peter, do you know why we broke up? And Peter's like, is that a trick question? And, you know, the game never sits down and just tells you in one big exposition dump or give you a big flashback to what is it that made Peter's and MJ's relationship fall apart. And there is kind of a sense that maybe neither of them is fully conscious of exactly what it is, because there was no, like, one precipitating moment. It is more of the sense of, like, this Peter Parker has taken the great power, great responsibility thing in, like, kind of a slightly different way, in a slightly more extreme way than most other versions of this character, where, like, he has taken so much of that responsibility onto himself that he's not willing to, like, cede that to anybody. And like, in particularly to a Mary Jane that has known that Peter is Spider-Man since they were both in high school, which is what this version of the character is, like, you can see how that is extremely patronizing to her when she is, just like with Peter, she wants to be out there and help things and is, like, active in the field and is in a profession as a journalist where she's there to try to make things better and to help the world. She just doesn't have fucking superpowers, so she can't do it by flying around and beating up people and sending them to Rikers Island, which is obviously what everyone should be doing. But yeah, she's stuck in this situation of being, you know, of feeling like she's Spider-Man's girlfriend. It's like she's Mary Jane Watson. She's the star reporter of the Daily Bugle that's uncovering all the, like, the actual crimes in the city. And she wants Peter to be able to recognize that. And he can't, because he sees all the responsibility of solving the city's problems just on himself. And it's a really impressive bit of storytelling that the game doesn't have to, like, sit down and tell you that and have Mary Jane just say all of that to Peter, it is slowly stripping back that, like, sort of onion of what the fuck happened in their relationship. Why are they not together? They clearly love each other. Like, they clearly want to be together. But there's something wrong with what Peter's doing and how he's approaching his relationships with her.
So let's talk about Mary Jane, because I think this is genuinely the most interesting and progressive, like, genuinely progressive presentation of the superhero girlfriend, as broadly defined, maybe in any superhero adaptation I've ever seen. I think it is exemplarily done. And it's not just that they put you in Mary Jane's shoes and they let you play some sections with her. It's that what that represents and what that allows them to do with the character, not just allows them to do, what they clearly want to do with the character is make Mary Jane Watson a person who exists when Spider-Man isn't there. And that's actually kind of a rare, weird thing to think about, because it's like, women in superhero stories have forever, in the good ones and the bad ones, they exist as a function of their relationship to the male protagonist. And that is not necessarily a problem in discrete individual films and circumstances, but it is a problem as an overall archetype in, you know, years and years of this genre existing, right? And what they do with Mary Jane here is it's not just that she has her own motivations and she can get out of, you know, trouble on her own. It's that she really is her own individual who has her own things she's dealing with. You get a sense that, like, you know, when Spider-Man is not there, he is not the only thing she is thinking about. And the way that relationship develops is that it's not only, and this is alone is a big step, that Peter Parker has to grow as a person and learn things to earn Mary Jane. She is not a reward for him. She is something that, she is a person who he has to become a better person to be with at the end of this game. And that is something a lot of superhero media does not do. The girlfriend is usually a reward at the end. But it's not just that Peter Parker has to grow and evolve. It's that over the course of the story, Mary Jane grows and evolves. And I think learns things about herself, about what her own heroism is, about where Peter is coming from, all these things. And so you just get to the end and she feels like such a more three-dimensional, rich, nuanced character than you ever see in this kind of media, both on her own, in relationship to the hero's relationship to her. I think it's done about as well as this kind of thing could be done. And then on top of that, she's just an interesting, fun character to play as, to watch, to listen to because of Laura Bailey's outstanding performance. I don't think they could have done any better with it.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I do think that a big part of it is, like, because it's the willingness both to show her side of the story just from, like, a narrative point of view, and that, like, there are lengthy sections of the game and multiple sections of the game where you see things from her point of view first, and then maybe Spider-Man enters into it, and maybe sometimes he even doesn't. But also it is that, like, it's not just narratively, it is that you are her. Like, you play as her, you adopt her point of view, and it's one of, like, the most powerful things about video games that most video games never fucking engage with is the amount of empathy and connectedness a player will feel for any character they play as long as they don't hate the game. If you hate the game, you probably hate the character you're playing as, just as a function of you not liking playing the game. But if you like playing the game and you like the story, you like the setting, you like the aesthetics, you like the game feel and the controls, you can make the character or the player play anybody, and eventually they will identify with them and have some sort of affection for them, even if it's a protagonist that you think is a dick face, like the GTA 5 ones. There is some undeniable sort of, like, weird association to have with them, is like, but I am playing as this dude, and there's, like, some weird thing here. There's some weird connection. Even with a protagonist that you don't like narratively, there's a connection there. And there are some games, like, I think Last of Us is one of the most accomplished of being able to use a shift in narrative perspective and playable character to, like, this incredible, you know, degree of narrative efficacy and translating so much to the player with such a simple thing of playing as a different character, even if they don't play much differently than the character you're normally playing as. So that's just something that, like, I wish video games generally broadly did a lot more, because it's such an effective tool, and so many video games never fucking do it and always have you play as whoever the main dude is, and it's almost always a main dude. And this game, it says, like, you know, not even just MJ, but also with Miles, but it says, like, let's get you in these people's shoes and see from their point of view, and it gives you a nice little bit of gameplay variety, and you get some nice slower sections with the stealth, and kind of like some narrative Gone Homey kind of stuff, or like where you're walking around and reading things and getting commentary. Like, I loved all the stuff in Norman Osborn's penthouse, where it's mostly you just like going around and sort of like getting these tidbits about who was Harry Osborn to MJ and Peter, who is Norman Osborn, what is their relationship like, and like filling in that backstory. And that's awesome. And it's just, or even just the first mission where you play as MJ, that's so much fun, where you're going around that museum and taking pictures of all the shit, and she has a little commentary on all the stuff you're taking pictures of all these weird like Chinese sculptures and stuff. All that is so effective at building this direct connection between the player and the character, and Insomniac just smartly leverages that for a broader, more ensemble cast than just Spider-Man in the Spider-Man game, because Spider-Man is so much more than just Spider-Man. He is his supporting cast, and the supporting cast of Peter Parker is, I think, the most important supporting cast that any superhero has by a lot. They're the most memorable, you know, like Mary Jane, J. Jonah Jameson, Aunt May, now Miles Morales, who's sort of slash supporting cast slash his own protagonist in his own series. Like, all of those characters are very memorable and fleshed out and compelling, because I think Peter Parker's world needs those other people in it. And this is the first one of these games to ever fucking do that. And it's amazing for a Spider-Man game to do that, but it's also, as I said, most games don't try to do it at all. And so having this opportunity to play as MJ and see the story from her perspective, grow with her as a character as she goes on her own journey, is such an unbelievably smart move to make. And it's something I think a lot of video games, as we move into this more story-focused, sort of like big AAA world we're in, so many games could learn a lot by paying attention to what Spider-Man does with what is just like a handful. It's like four or five times you play as MJ and a couple of times you play as Miles, and they're not huge sections, and just a little bit of it does so much to broaden and flesh out the story.
And they're so good. Like, this cannot be emphasized enough. They are good sections of the game. Because I'll admit, when you first cut into MJ's perspective, I was kind of bracing myself, because while I agree that this can be a very powerful mechanism for making you empathize with a character, put you in their shoes... it doesn't always work. Like, there are plenty of games that have tried this, and those are the boring parts of the game, right? Like, where you can't run or move fast or do anything interesting, and it's really just, now I am walking around letting story happen around me, and it's lazy. I think that happens a lot. That's not this game. When you are playing as MJ, there are interesting things for you to do, and they are different than Spider-Man. You know, that section in Norman Osborn's penthouse is really fun, and it's challenging, and when all the guards are there, and there's some really cool stuff for you to find, and it is fun to play. It is a cool break from the main Spider-Man action. It's paced very well, because these things almost always come in when you feel like you're ready to maybe do something a little different, so they pace them out perfectly. And again, it just brings you closer to that character than you ever could. And if the point of this is to make MJ her own person and really make it feel like she is an existing being in this world beyond Peter, the gameplay stuff is crucial, because she's doing things that are absolutely elemental to the story that Spider-Man not only is not doing, but could not do. Like, Peter Parker Spider-Man could not do the thing she does in Norman Osborn's penthouse. Not because he is not, you know, smart and a good hero, but because he wouldn't think to do those things. And he's Spider-Man, and he's at a much more, you know, like, city level of the world, and she can be down on the ground level and actually get some of this basic shit done. And representing that through gameplay is perfect. And it's maybe used even more powerfully with Miles Morales, because you're telling the Miles Morales origin story here. If you're not playing as him in the moments after he's just seen his father blow up, you're not doing it right, because that really forges this immediate connection with Miles Morales, where the moment you have really substantively met him as a character and the first big thing happens to him, you're right there in his shoes, seeing this world through his eyes. And again, that forges such a connection that I feel like it not only pays off in this game, because Miles is a great character in this game alone, but when we get to the sequel and you're going to actually be swinging around the city as Miles Morales Spider-Man, the seeds that they laid here are going to matter so much to that payoff.
Yeah, and Miles is an even better example of that, sort of like just how I think brilliantly effective the playable shorthand is for video games, and why it blows my mind that so many games just never try that out or do anything with it, is because – you know, Mary Jane is a pre-established character that almost anybody who's picking up a Spider-Man game knows who Mary Jane is. Like, she's in all the fucking, she's in the movies, you know, it's Kirsten Dunst. It's Zendaya in the new one. That was a fucking awesome moment at the end of that movie. And she's one of the most iconic, you know, she's just below Lois Lane as, like, the most iconic supporting female character and love interest in a comic book thing. Like, she's super well-known character. So when you play as Mary Jane, even regardless of, like, the fact that obviously we technically knew that you play as Mary Jane from a trailer and they kind of talked about it, but even just, like, experientially in the game, when you play as Mary Jane, it's a cool, but it's not a huge surprise. It's like, ah, it's Mary Jane. When you play as Miles Morales, he's a character that's only been around for a couple of years. Most people don't really know him that well. He's about to get his own movie in the Spider-Verse one, but he's not been in much of the extended Spider-Man fiction. I think he's in a couple of the newest cartoon. I think he's in that a little bit. But, you know, there's not a huge expectation around Miles Morales, and people generally just know Miles Morales if they know him as he's the other Spider-Man. It's like they don't know him as he's just a normal kid living in New York that doesn't have any powers yet. Like, nobody knows that side of the story. Nobody knows that side of the character. And he's not really set up previously in the game. He has no relationship with Peter Parker or MJ or Aunt May when he's first introduced in the game. So it's like you have no narrative reason to really know anything about Miles other than that Jefferson Davis is his father. And so when you cut to his point of view and you realize, I am controlling this character now, you immediately understand he is important. He exists in this world, and, like, I care about him because, like, I am, like, now entrusted basically as the player with his safety and guiding him through all this shit and, like, you know, sending him on his journey. And when you shift to his point of view, again, even though I technically knew that at some point in this game that this was going to happen because I had heard about it in an interview, it still, like, kind of gave me almost, like, weird goosebumps of, like, oh, like, I'm, like, Miles is important. And it communicates that so viscerally when you have to control a person. And that's something that's so effective about that. And I, that's, you know, that scene is so, so dramatically powerful because it's not Peter Parker having to deal with this. It is the son of the guy of Jefferson Davis that the cool police officer you've been spending time with. You don't see that from Peter's point of view. You don't deal with it from Peter's point of view. You have to deal with it from his son's point of view.
And we should talk about how great the Jefferson Davis characterization is and what a masterstroke that was, because I don't know enough about Miles Morales that I did not pick up on the fact immediately that this was supposed to be his dad, you know? So it was kind of later when you see he has a family and Miles is his son that I realized, oh shit, this dude is toast. Uh-huh. But up until then, I just was like, oh, this is this really cool cop I'm getting to spend time with. And there is a substantial mission or two that you do with Jefferson Davis, and he is characterized through gameplay he does with Spider-Man. And again, he's being able to do things that Spider-Man could not do, and they get to team up and do all this cool shit, and he's this awesome character, and you just grow to love this guy. And as you grow to love this guy, this terrible thing happens, and they don't send you into Peter's shoes, they send you into his son's shoes, and you already have that understanding of this was a great guy. We don't just have to take, you know, the word for it that, well, this is Miles' dad and that's why he cares about him. It's that we've done things with him and we know he's a great guy, and you feel Miles' pain so much more because of that. I think every single thing with Miles Morales in this game is a fucking masterstroke. Like, my favorite scene in the game, other than maybe some of the stuff with Doc Ock at the end, could be there's a scene after Miles has his own little playable mission where he's going out, I think, to get the antibiotics.
Yeah.
And he comes back and Spider-Man comes there. And they're chatting, and they wind up, Spider-Man teaches him how to fight. And so he and Miles are doing this little, like, sparring session. I teared up. That was the most emotional I got playing this game, because there's just something, like, because Miles had been built up so well at that point, you knew he had this kind of hero worship for Peter, and you knew, given all that he was going through, that this was important to him. And I think that's one of the most heroic things Spider-Man does in this game, is spend 5 minutes just being with this kid and being a friend. I think it's one of the most just quietly, understatedly powerful things I've seen in any piece of superhero media. It's a really great scene.
Yeah, definitely. It is something of where it's the other benefit of doing this with the supporting cast is that, like, it also builds up Spider-Man, and you get to see Spider-Man in from a very different light than you would otherwise. And it's those kinds of moments that, like, lend him this, like, almost like mythic level of, you know, presence in the cities, that you see him in that moment more from Miles' point of view than from Peter's, because you had just been playing as Miles. And so you see, you don't see Peter Parker, the guy who's, you know, constantly fucking up and just got evicted and can't get back together with his girlfriend and is like, you know, is juggling a million plates and half of them are breaking, you know. You don't see that Spider-Man. You see, this is motherfucking Spider-Man. This is the guy that Miles is like sitting in like high school and looks out the window and sees this red and blue blur swing past his window and punch like an old man with a flying suit that's like robbing a bank or something and like brings him to justice. This is the dude that's fighting the guy who shoots fucking lightning from his fingers swinging around like the Empire State Building, you know? Like, this is Spider-Man. And it's really hard sometimes to really communicate that like superheroic presence if you don't have, I mean, it's impossible to communicate it if you don't have another point of view looking at it that is almost like an audience surrogate, and you get to imagine not yourself being the superhero, but yourself existing in a world where superheroes exist. And that's such a like powerful emotion, I feel. And that Miles section you're talking about was really powerful for me from that point of view, also from like his character building point of view, because it's when Spider-Man swings off after that and you just see him like bolt into the sky is where I'm sitting there and like I'm feeling myself being like 14 years old reading Spider-Man comics and like, you know, Spider-Man as a character being this ideal version of something that I want to reach. And like me and Miles are so connected in our admiration for Spider-Man in that moment that you don't get when you're just from like Spidey's point of view for the whole thing.
Absolutely. And incidentally, the motherfucking Spider-Man is my favorite Spider-Man comic book.
Yes.
I just think Amazing's good, Spectacular's good, but the motherfucking Spider-Man, the short-lived 1970s blaxploitation Spider-Man, is the best one.
Yeah,
they should really do an adaptation of that.
Yeah, they should bring Spider-Man Loves Mary Jane back, and they should bring the motherfucking Spider-Man back.
Yes. All right. One other Mary Jane mission I forgot to mention is I fucking love the Mary Jane mission where you are in the
Grand
New York
Central
subway
station. Yeah.
Grand Central Station. And it's a Spider-Man mission, basically, but you mostly don't play as Spider-Man. You play as Mary Jane from the other side of it. And it is also such a smart move that that is the only time she is sort of damsel in distress, and she's really not. She is not taken hostage. She goes to this place and the whole station is taken hostage and she is one of them. But it is like her direct actions that enable Spider-Man to save the day. And it's not just lip service they tell you that. It's that they put you in her shoes and you do it as Mary Jane. That is just like they clearly had the right stuff on the brain here and they were attentive to the issues that they need to be attentive to. And I think the whole thing is just throwing down the gauntlet for future, like, people adapting this kind of character, you know?
Yeah, the Grand Central Station one is my favorite. As far as, like, a mission goes for, like, you playing as someone other than Spider-Man, that's my favorite. It's because it's both really cool from a narrative perspective and puts MJ, because it's like, she is technically, quote-unquote, held hostage, but it's also, like, they really fuck up by holding Mary Jane Watson hostage because,
yes.
Like, it's kind of that, like, Rorschach thing of, like, you know, I'm not trapped in here with you. You're trapped in here with me. I'm going to fuck all your shit up by stealing your iPad and, like, blowing everything up. This is like, you really fucked up when I walked into this place. It's kind of the how that feels. But it also just, like, from a gameplay point of view, it is so fucking cool. Again, like, seeing Spider-Man from different perspectives of instead of being up on Grand Central Station and, like, webbing down and grabbing a dude, it's so fucking dope to walk up and be like, hey, Spidey, fuck that guy. And then Spider-Man just drops out of fucking nowhere, like, whips the dude's gun, whacks him in the face with it, and just webs him up and just zips up to the sky at, like, 50 miles an hour. And then you look up, and you can, if you lift the camera up, you can see Spider-Man just up there with all these criminals hanging from the ceiling. It is such a, just a viscerally awesome fucking way to experience that, and it's so much more interesting than if it had just been another Spider-Man stealth section, which I like the Spider-Man stealth sections in this, but it's so fucking cool to just see that done from the other perspective, when from a gameplay point of view, you're doing very similar stuff than if you had been playing as Spider-Man, but you're seeing it from such a more interesting perspective, and there is something just like, again, like, just very uniquely satisfying about not having to be the guy that actually beats them up. You're like so high up on the chain that you're like, nah, that guy, fuck him, take him out. Like, you don't have to get your hands dirty. Spider-Man just does what you tell him to do. It's a really cool thing. I thought that was just a really smart idea for a mission.
Absolutely. So, we love Mary Jane. We love Miles Morales. How excited are you to play as the Miles Morales Spider-Man next time?
Oh, it's so good. I'm very glad, because I suspected that they would do this, but I wasn't 100% sure. I'm very happy that they wrapped up this game with giving him the powers, and like that is a part of this story, because I feel like... Because it needs to be a part of the story, because a big part of the story is Peter learning to, you know, accept help from other people, and kind of he... is also, as being older, he's kind of moving into a mentor role himself that like Otto was in for him, but hopefully he can be a better mentor for Miles and not try to kill him at the end of the next game. Who knows? Symbiote's going to happen.
If they want to go dark, they could do it.
Yeah, but yeah, so it's like, you know, that relationship needs to be there, and like it makes so much sense from just a thematic point of view for Miles to become Spider-Man, way beyond the like, well, he technically needs to be Spider-Man because he's the other Spider-Man man. But yeah, that I really love that scene in the post credits where Miles and Peter, two people who in no way need help moving a desk, are moving a desk into the. I just love this. Like, it's you have two people with the proportion and strength of a spider, both pretending to have a hard time lift this desk, which is very funny to me. It's a very low-key
joke. I hadn't thought
joke.
About that. That's great.
It's very good. It's like they're both like fake straining to lift this fucking desk to get into Peter's apartment. But yeah, that whole gag about like the puberty stuff, and then I thought it was just a very elegant way of him flipping up and jumping on the ceiling, and then Peter being like, "Oh fuck it, awesome!" And it's like I get to do it too, and then like kind of share this like Spider Bro moment up on the ceiling. Very
like,
good.
This is one person I can tell I'm Spider Man without any guilt.
Yes, because like if I tell Miles that I'm Spider Man and like that gets him into trouble, it's like. Dude, he's fucking Spider-Man too. Like if I can't trust him with it, I can't trust myself with it.
Yes, it's so great. And you touched on something I also wanted to mention, which is that this game does have a lot of seeding for an eventual sequel. You know, so it's got the setup with Miles Morales is going to be Spider-Man. It's got some stuff with Norman and Harry Osborn. There are things that we're going to do more with, but it does not feel sequel baity at any point. It feels like they tell a full, complete story. The character arcs come to their natural resolution. I don't feel like I'm left wanting with anything in this game, other than like some little DLC hints, like we're going to get more with Black Cat, but that's such an immediate future thing, and it's also not a main narrative component of the game. Other than that, it's completely, you know, Miles' story for this part of the story is told. Him getting bit at the end is a very natural culmination, not just of Miles' arc in this game, but Peter's arc as well in relation to Miles. So I agree with that completely, and I think it's a very artful way to do the, we're also going to set up some things for a sequel, because this is a big, fun world, and there's lots of things to do.
Yeah, that it's like, because it walks that line perfectly of where I feel very satisfied with the story that they told, and I feel like everything that like I needed to be explained and wanted to be explored with this story was explored in this story. But then also I am so jonesing for a sequel, and like not just one, like I'm like am seeing the roadmap of like the next like 5 million Spider-Man games of like, okay, then they can fucking do this with like Kraven and the symbiote, and maybe we shouldn't do this now, but now we're just talking about it. They are 100% going to fucking kill Peter Parker at some point and do Superior Spider-Man. There's no way this Peter Parker lives for two more Spider-Man games. This fucker's dead. He's so dead. Either at the end of the next game or the end of the first act of the third game, like, don't get too attached to this Peter Parker because he's not long for this world. That is my prediction.
Okay, I know what you're talking about. I know exactly where you're going with this, but I'm guessing there are a lot of people who don't know the ins and outs of the Superior Spider-Man and how that came to be, so explain your fan theory for a second.
Yeah, well, and this is actually a good way to segue into talking about Otto, because it is how they also sort of, like, re-jigger that Dr. Octopus character, which, if you don't know my feelings on Dr. Octopus, re-listen to the Spider-Man 2 podcast, or listen to it the first time we're talking about Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2. Dr. Octopus is my favorite comic book villain. Dr. Octopus is fucking dope. Dr. Octopus in this game is fucking dope. There's one complaint about this game is that you never get to play as Dr. Octopus. Someday I will get the video game where I get to play as Dr. Octopus, and maybe that will be if they do a Superior Spider-Man story, because that is, while I have not read those comics yet, I will get there in 600 issues. But it is because it's in the middle of Dan Slott's run. I will get there eventually, I swear. It is a storyline where Dr. Octopus is dying. I think he has cancer or something, because every fucking comic book character has cancer at some point if they've been around long enough.
A lot of people do, too, if they're around long enough.
It's true. It's true of a lot of people. It is, but it is absurdly true of comic book characters that like it's everybody. It's like it gets a bit silly. But yeah, so because I think Chameleon has had cancer, Vulture has had cancer, I think Elektra has had cancer, Kraven has had cancer, Dr. Octopus is, it's like, okay, calm the fuck down, guys. Like, come
up. Both of the Osborns have, like, that's the whole plot of Amazing Spider-Man 2, the shitty movie.
It's just, it feels like it's a very, like, convenient and kind of lazy narrative device for things of, like, excuse for, like, ah, he's dying from something, just give him cancer. And so, but yeah, so Dr. Octopus is dying, and so his plan is to live, and this is a comic book, so you have to spend a lot of fucking discipline, because it's a pretty absurd idea. I'm going to swap my consciousness with my greatest foe, Spider-Man, and live as Spider-Man and have him die in my dying body. And because comic books are ridiculous, that actually fucking works. And so Peter Parker, for like a couple of years of like real world time of like probably like, I think there's like 20 something issues of Superior Spider-Man, Peter Parker dies in Dr. Octopus's body, and Dr. Octopus lives in Peter's and decides, I'm going to, not only am I going to be Spider-Man, I'm going to be a superior Spider-Man. I'm going to show how, if given the same resources, I can be even better at what Peter wants to be as Spider-Man than what he could be. And it kind of like takes this opportunity to almost like turn over a new leaf, and then, you know, the storyline goes from there. I don't know all the ins and outs past that point. But it's a very silly idea for a story, and it's probably a very silly setup for what, from what I understand, is like a really good run of comics that like you have to like buy a lot of bullshit to get into there. But the one thing I love about this game, that's true about a lot of stuff, but like it's probably most true about Dr. Octopus here, is that if they do go down that route, they have set it up in such a smoother way by having one Otto and Peter having this really interesting, very complicated mentor, you know, protege relationship, father-son relationship in this game. And also, I thought the excuse for Otto becoming evil and becoming Dr. Octopus as being he has this degenerative disease that is making him lose control of his motor functions and his body, that is such a smart change and such a smart take on this character. And I am so fucking here for the transhumanist Dr. Octopus, that his whole thing is he wants people to, like, you know, to transcend their physical bodies and be, like, you know, mental creatures with super powerful, like, abstract mechanical forms. That is so on point and so cool and such an interesting, again, like, different take on the character that feels very identifiably Dr. Octopus and an idea that Doc Ock would have, but is not exactly what we've seen before in any of the movies or the cartoons or the games.
I am so here for the transhumanist Dr. Octopus. I want that as the critic's quote on Spider-Man 2, the video game box. Just, that can be, it can be called Marvel Spider-Man, subtitle, I am so here for the transhumanist Dr. Octopus.
Because it's so fucking good. I was
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, when I got halfway through the game and started to see what they were doing, when Otto starts making that little turn of, like, it's not just him being like, and we're going to protect the future of humanity with the technology we're using. It's like, and we're going to transcend our physical meat bags that we live in and live as pure thought beings in the multiverse. Like, he, like, goes so far. And you know, and then you, obviously you come to understand all the reasons for it of, like, why he's so fixated on this idea, because he feels he's limited and trapped in his body that doesn't do what he wants it to do. It makes so much sense. But I was just like, when you start getting those phone calls and the, like, the slow progression of Peter at first being like, man, Doc is like, he seems so excited, I'm so happy, he's like, you know, really, like, picked himself back up and is back into it. I've, like, he was so down after, like, our project got abandoned, and slowly moving into, like, maybe you should slow down, Otto. Like, maybe you're going a little bit too far. We started from, let's help people, you know, that have had their, like, limbs amputated or have lost use of their limbs with, like, really advanced prosthetics, and we've moved to, let's put everybody's mind into robot bodies like it's Near Automata. It's, like, a really big leap once you got to that point.
Yes, so I agree. I had not made the connection to Superior Spider-Man while playing the game, but as soon as you said it, it sounds like a natural thing to do. And that's crazy, because I remember when that happened, we all thought it was the dumbest idea in the fucking world, but then that comic book was apparently pretty good, and then the way they set it up here, I agree, they must be planning that. Now, that doesn't mean Peter will be permanently dead, because he does come back to life in the comics, right?
Yes, yeah, I think his, like, consciousness is hidden somewhere deep in his body and reasserts itself for some comic book bullshit.
Yes. So as long as they, you know, make it, they've done the foundations very well, if they do it right, and if they maybe allied some of the weird rapey stuff with Mary Jane that happened in the comics and maybe don't get into that as much, this could be a great idea. So I think the plan is this game was called Spider-Man. The next game should be called The Spectacular Spider-Men. Yes. It's going to be two Spider-Mans. And then the third game can be called The Superior Spider-Man. And at that point, it'll actually have branched out, and you'll have the Superior Spider-Man, but you'll also get, later that year, a Miles Morales-only Spider-Man game called Ultimate Spider-Man. And we'll just have fun with it.
There you go. But also, like, I just think I would, like, because my, like, vision for the future is that, like, you know, that Miles eventually has to become the Spider-Man when Peter's out of the picture. Because that's one of the things that's so great about this game is that they just get to put Miles in from the jump, you know? And so it's like Miles is a pre-existing character in this universe. They don't have to jump through all these ridiculous fucking hoops of Miles is like stranded from the dying Ultimate universe in our big crossover event where we destroyed that comic book line but wanted to salvage the characters that people liked, so we brought him over. So it's like if you read a comic with Miles Morales today, he is technically from another fucking multiverse universe. It's like ridiculous. Here he just gets to be another character that lives in New York that gets spider powers. It's so much smoother, and it sets up a good arc where, like, I can really see if Peter dies at some point in the next game or the third game or whenever, and then, you know, Dr. Octopus, Otto, like, hatches his ultimate scheme of, like, I'm not going to transcend my human form of, like going into a mechanical body. I'm going to transcend my human form by translating my consciousness into the, like, most peak perfect human body that I can find, which is the guy that has the superpowers. Like, that's such a clear connection to me. And then it leaves this, like, Ultimate Spider-Man versus Superior Spider-Man showdown. I am so here for that. That is such a good idea, and they just need to keep on. They need to at least get to that point. They need to at least make three games, because that'd be way too much for two games. But they need to get there because this is so exciting.
There are so many possibilities. And the game is a huge hit, and they're gonna get to make as many fucking sequels as they want. So
yes. Yeah. But that's enough staring into the future. Let's talk about the here and now. Let's dig a little bit deeper into Otto, because he is, like, the real villain of the game. You have Martin Lee and Mr. Negative is a really good character for that kind of, like, first two acts and kind of, like, easing you in as Dr. Octopus is slowly constructing himself in the background. But it really
Doc is... Doc Ock is the third act twist villain.
Yes, exactly. And he's really, like, the meat of the game. Of Martin Lee does a good job of setting it up, and he's connected to the Osborn stuff, and it's a good, like, he's also a minor kind of mentor figure to Peter and has the connection to Feast. It's like, I think he serves his role well, but he really is kind of like a Trojan horse villain to, like, get Doc Ock in there at the end, where once that third act starts and it has built up all the way, and you have all these heartbreaking moments between Peter and Otto, where it's like, you know, that last one where he reveals, you know, he has that degenerative disease, and they hug, is so heartwarming and so tragic because you know what's going to happen. And then you get the raft breakout, and you get the Sinister Six, and you realize, you know, obviously, if you saw the E3 demo, you realized before this point, when you see all the diagrams of the raft on the whiteboard in the lab and stuff, is like, fucking Otto's been planning this the whole time. He's been slowly building this in the background. He's had these ideas. And then it finally culminates into the reveal for Peter that he finally comes to understand just how far gone Otto is and how really, truly frightening Dr. Octopus is in this game. And it's something I found very effective in that kind of third act twist kind of way is he is beating Spider-Man really soundly from as soon as he appears. And he is so imposing. His arms are so powerful and have been built up so well because you have been building those arms with Otto and seeing just how effective they are and how fast they are and how, like, you know, they can transform into all these shapes. It's as soon as he makes that appearance and he climbs up that wall as Dr. Octopus, it's just like you feel so fucked in that moment as Spider-Man. And both from, like, a physical level and on an emotional level.
Yes, I agree so much. And I think they could not have seeded the Otto-Octavius relationship any better in this game, because he is just such this fully integrated part of the world from beginning to end. With everything you said about him as Dr. Octopus, I also think what makes the final confrontation so ludicrously powerful to me, the entire thing where they're sliding down the building, and then when they're in the rubble together and they have their final, like, shout down, where they're just shouting at each other, is that they don't let Otto off the hook at any point here. It is not oh God, you had this like chip in your head that went awry and it's the arms made you evil, which is sort of the Spider-Man 2 thing, which I don't mind. That's in a 2-hour movie, that was a very smart choice and they did it very well. But in this game, it's so much more emotionally difficult to accept than that, because it's not something went awry with the chip. It's that he was bad. And it's that he had been planning this from the beginning, and this is who he actually is, and this is what he was actually planning, and that does not negate the mentor he was to Peter, but the mentor he was to Peter does not negate his evil, and he fucking killed Aunt May, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we also learn. Like, Aunt May fucking dies because of Otto Octavius, and indirectly because of what Peter does to him. I like that they don't make it such a direct connection of, like, Peter created Doc Ock, like the lizard in Amazing Spider-Man 1 or something. It's
right.
He helped with it, but it's not Peter's fault, you know, that like
no.
He
but because, he's still, because he's Peter, he's still going to right. carry it as his fault, even with like you as the audience member understands like there's nothing you could have realistically done to stop this. Like this was the path that he was on all the time.
And realizing that he was on that path, and when Peter has that outburst where he says, and I love that they use this word, I worshipped you, you know, like you were like a god to me, and him trying to make Otto see the pain he's feeling in that moment, and Otto just doesn't care at this point. And it is this really dynamic presentation of villainy for this kind of story, and it blew me away. It's some powerful shit.
Yeah, just that whole final 30 minutes where Peter has to make his anti-Dr. Octopus suit and then go and fight him on the top of Oscorp, and that whole scene between Dr. Octopus and Norman Osborn is so good, and Norman just not fucking giving an inch, being like, fuck you. I love the relationship between Ock and Norman as this, like, very evil, twisted version of, like, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, in a way. It's like, Dr. Octopus is the evil Woz. It's just like, you know, Norman Osborn is, like, the business dude who's brilliant, but, like, kind of in a business way, and the Woz, or Dr. Octopus, is the one who's, like, really did all the science stuff and, like, feels underappreciated in that relationship. It's a good dynamic. I love Norman Osborn's little, like, presence in the game in that way. But yeah, that whole scene. But then what really hit me that kind of sets it up so well is when you know, Peter takes that really big blow and like part of his face mask gets ripped off and he's trying to hide it, and then Doc Ock reveals that he's understood, probably since he saw the suit at the beginning of the game. It's like, you're not the dude that makes the suit for Spider-Man. You are Spider-Man. And I was just pretending not to know. And Peter feels so... There's just this like great reaction where at first he's like, you knew? And he's just surprised. And then Otto starts like rambling as a supervillain. And Peter's thinking, and he comes to this realization, like, you knew. Like, you knew that I was Spider-Man this whole time. Not just, like, some, like, faceless guy who's the superhero. Like, the guy, the person that you said is, like, a son to you. And at this point, Octopus, Doc Ock has almost killed Peter, like, 3 different times. And has released the Sinister Six and all that stuff. And that like, amount of betrayal, like, what Yuri Lowenthal brings to the performance in those last moments of, like, is so raw and powerful to me of just... You know, that just, you knew, like, you, and so much is communicated in just that one phrase that pushes Peter to that point of, like, where, again, he has that temper and he just fucking lets go of, like, no, I'm not being, you know, goody-goody two-shoes Spider-Man anymore. I'm beating the shit out of you right now for what you're doing, and getting, like, pushed to that point. It's a really powerful climax.
Absolutely. Norman Osborn is also an interesting character to talk about, because I love what he symbolizes in this game, because what Norman Osborn is, in addition to being just the world's biggest fucking red-haired douchebag, you know, and just annoying looking and annoying sounding, he's like evil Andrew Cuomo, basically, in this game, of just like, he's both like a corrupt, ineffectual politician and like kind of a supervillain under the surface, is that he's the system. That if you confronted Norman Osborn and figured out how to bring that political machine down, a lot of the stuff Spidey deals with on the day-to-day basis in this game would be improved, if not fixed outright. Like, Norman symbolizes this bigger system going on. And Peter, throughout this game, I don't think it's that he's being, like, completely stupid or naive, but Spider-Man can't confront the system. Like, Spider-Man, as he is built, is not the guy who can go take down a political machine and improve New York politically. He's kind of the micro guy, you know, cleaning up the messes as they come up. But you do get this question from Martin Lee and from Dr. Octopus several times, is that you should be going after him, not after me. And Spider-Man isn't wrong for going after them. They're terrorizing and killing people, and they have to be stopped. But there is also this point of, like, but yeah, Norman is also this big evil that we also really have to take care of at some point. And I like that there's no moment where, like, it doesn't end with, like, Spider-Man going to his apartment and being like, I'm watching you now, you better not do bad shit anymore. Because that's not really in his purview in this role. And that's such a kind of cliched thing to do. So I think the whole presentation of Norman is fascinating to me.
Yeah, and there's that little moment that is so smart and key in that climactic sequence where, you know, Otto drops Norman and he falls, and then of course Spider-Man saves him at the end, and kind of like, there's a good little, like, you know, Spider-Man saves him, but like he still kind of chucks him on the cement rooftop, and probably like Norman's gonna have a couple of bruises when he wakes up from that one. But he gets up and kind of dusts himself off, goes to this door, opens the door, and there's this good little close-up on his face. He gives this little shit-eating grin of like, I made it out of this one. And it's like that little, like, it's such a good little moment of that they hang on Norman for a little bit to be like, it's like, because it is such an open question of, like, how do you deal with this guy? How do you deal with this threat? Because he is the real problem in so many ways. And like you said, Spider-Man, at least in this game, is not equipped to deal with that. And it's one of those things, again, like, leaving things open for a sequel. Green Goblin is obviously going to have to come in. They very directly tease the symbiote thing at the end. That's like, I'm excited to see the next game try to maybe tackle some of those questions now that Peter is maybe in more of a, will be in more of a position to deal with it once he doesn't have, you know, everything falling down around him with the Sinister Six and Dr. Octopus and everything. And it feels like at the end of this game, maybe Peter has like a newfound awareness of, maybe I shouldn't just accept that I can't deal with the Norman Osborn situation. Maybe there is something I can do. Like, I'm curious to see if they'll tackle that, because it feels like such a pointed moment when Otto says, why aren't you going after him? He's the guy you should be taking down.
Yes, and I hope the next game is a campaign simulator where Spider-Man decides to run for mayor of New York. And I don't mean Peter Parker, I mean Spider-Man runs for mayor, and he does it in the costume, and he, like, goes to campaign events, and you have to, like, do quick-time events to get through the speech, and then you have to go, like, you know, shake voters' hands and do canvassing, and, like, there's a whole thing where you play as, like, Spider-Man's campaign manager, and she's trying to get all this together, and at the end of the game, if you get enough votes, you become mayor of New York City, and then the third game can be you dealing with the bureaucracy of a very complex city like New York.
I think you're aiming too small, Jonathan. I don't think he shouldn't be trying to become mayor of New York. He should try to become president of the United States and have Miles Morales as another Spider-Man be his vice president. So the running bill is Spider-Man, Spider-Man. I vote for Spider-Man, Spider-Man.
That would be the fourth game. He's got to have some local political experience, like build a coalition.
Does he? Does he need to have local political experience? Is that a thing you need to be president? I didn't get that memo.
It's a thing, Normal. I don't know. I don't know the rules anymore.
Spider-Man, man.
That's true.
He's got like 15 million followers on Twitter.
They, you know, and if he started, you know, tweeting like, build that web, you know, he'd get a lot of followers.
Yep.
All right. Anyway, anything else to say about this game, the story, the characters? I should give a shout out for the music. The music in this game is outstanding. It's a great Spider-Man score. I don't know if I would put it quite on par with like Danny Elfman, but it is propulsive and big and orchestral and iconic, and I love it.
Yeah, and it particularly in that last section, it does so much work with like those main themes. It's one of those situations where like I hadn't realized how much affection I had for the Spider-Man theme. Then when it like gets that huge reprisal at the end of the game when he puts on the new suit, it's really good music.
Aunt May, I think, is a very good, mostly standard characterization of her. Her death scene is it's not just like a bold choice to kill Aunt May. It's a beautiful scene. I love that she, in classic Aunt May fashion, she really did know he was Spider-Man. She just didn't say. And they have this moment and, you know, she says, you know what you need to do. And he almost puts the cure in and almost does this one selfish thing. And he stops himself. And I don't know if there is any purer Spider-Man moment than that, you know what I mean?
Yes, that is the like most Spider-Man. That is peak Peter Parker, is like the I have done everything I possibly can. I have saved so many people and done so much, and yet somehow still at the very end, I am the one, I get fucked, and the people I care about get fucked, but, like, I have to focus on always on the greater good and on always doing what is the best thing I can do. It is, yeah, it is very Spider-Man, and it is, like, that game earns that moment so thoroughly. It is, yeah, like you said, it's just so beautifully done. It's that kind of the scene that makes you really appreciate being able to have a, like, unique, specific, like, divorced take on the character that, like, allows you to take risks and do things that the main source material would never really be able to do this scene. Or if they do this scene, it wouldn't have the power, because if it's a main comic book, like, MA would be coming back. You'd make a deal with the devil. You do whatever you need to do to get that character back into the continuity, because comic books since the 1990s can't deal with change. So this game is able to, like, land that scene, assert that scene, and own that scene, and that feels like that scene will continue to be, like, this thing that hangs over this version of the character for the sequels and in the future. But it is also just, like, a the perfect way to end this game, and the perfect way to sort of, like, summarize what it is to be Spider-Man and why, you know, it is hard to be Spider-Man, but necessary to have the person that can make those kinds of choices.
Absolutely. So, it's a good way to end the game. I think this is probably a natural place to start wrapping up this conversation. Is there anything else to say about Marvel's Amazing Spider-Man game that is not called Amazing Spider-Man at this moment in time?
Yes, what is for right now the superior Spider-Man game, Marvel Spider-Man. The photo mode is really fucking good.
Oh, right.
I made a couple of tweets putting in some of my favorite photos.
The photo you got of him on Avengers Tower, and then you turned that into a cover, it took me a while to figure out what you had done there. It's a very good use of the photo mode.
Yes. Also, the vintage comic book that has, like, the comic book suit that has the sort of cel-shaded look is so fucking good and so perfect.
I love it.
It's my favorite suit in the game. It just lives. It's so gorgeous, and it's the best one for the photo mode. I have now a new wallpaper for my PS4, because I like that.
Nice.
You can just take photos on your PS4 and make them your wallpaper. Yeah, so it's like it's a really fun photo mode. There's a lot of cool stuff you can do, lots of good filters, and you can, you know, change the depth of field and all that kind of stuff that the other ones do. But then also you can make fake Spider-Man comic book covers, and that's a lot of fun.
Awesome. All right. Speaking of PS4 photo mode, like wallpapers and stuff, I should note, since I'm playing Dragon Quest XI now, I wanted a Dragon Quest XI, like, theme for my PS4. There is not one in the U.S. PSN store. There is one in the Japanese PSN store, and it's free. And it does not have any Dragon Quest-specific music on it, which annoys me, because I wish there was some cool Dragon Quest music you could put on your theme. But it does have cool visuals, and it changes all the icons to be slime-related, which is fun. So
nice.
I will recommend that for Dragon Quest XI players. But also, Spider-Man photo mode is just a built-in wallpaper machine, so there's no going wrong right now. There's plenty of great ways to make your PS4 look good.
It's Spider-Man is such a gorgeous game, and it photographs very well.
Yes.
It is. I highly recommend loading up Rock Reflections of a Superhero and swinging around that city and taking dope photos and beating people up and taking secret photo ops of, like, the other landmarks and stuff. It's a good time with that game. It's very relaxing.
Well, this has been fun. Spider-Man is great. I can't recommend it highly enough. It is easily, at this point, recognizing that we do have a lot of year to go left.
Yeah.
I think it's in my top two or three for the year. It's an outstanding game.
Absolutely. It comes with the highest recommendation. It will definitely be on my top 10 list. Who knows where it will be at?
Yes, because I don't think there are 10 new games I'll be playing between now and the end of the year.
I don't think it would be physically possible to play 10 more games.
So we will talk about it again, probably when the DLC comes out, because that's actually not that far from now, but also definitely at the end of the year. We loved this game. We loved talking about it. Next week we'll talk about some new stuff, maybe some Dragon Quest if you play some of that. We'd have a little discussion on that, and we'll see where we go from here. But we've done Spider-Man for 5 weeks in a row now, and maybe it's time to talk about something else.
We should just go back in and rebrand all these episodes as the Spider Month.